Hi, everybody. We're live.
Live and in color.
Except we don't do video.
Yeah. You know, I got to tell you right now that there is a thunderstorm happening outdoors. John apparently lost power for several hours earlier today. So this is going to be a little bit more of a stressful ATP recording for us than it normally is. We'll see how it goes.
I feel great. I just live on a barrier island.
Yeah, I'm sure your house will still be there in 15 years.
Anyway.
All right. Well, we can dive right in. All right. That was just for you bootleg people.
Yeah.
Hey, so news, breaking news even. There is not another holiday to celebrate. Unfortunately, I wish I could come up with one. I'm so sorry, John. But I have different
good
news.
Give him time, listeners. He will find more.
It's anniversaries you were celebrating, not holidays.
They're all holidays to me, John. Okay. But anyway, we have some breaking news. It turns out that we ordered another shipment of mugs, I don't know, like a month or two back. It was a little while ago. And
In January.
Thank you. And we used the little tool that our friends at Cotton Bureau put together to email those that have said, hey, email me when this comes back, please. And it turns out that, you know, as expected, not everyone who requested that email has actually purchased a mug. So if you're looking for a mug, you can go to atp.fm/store and get yourself a mug. And John, these are the red interiors. Is that correct?
They're almost all red interiors. There's a handful of gray interiors left if that's what you want.
All right. And if you don't get a choice when you check out, then hey, it's a surprise.
No, you do. It's on the product page.
Oh, okay. Fair enough. There's also a smattering of pint glasses. There are not many. So for both of these, I would suggest acting sooner rather than later. But particularly for the pint glasses, there's very few of those remaining. So if you're interested, go snatch those up.
And this is not, to be clear, this is not our pre-WWDC merch sale. We're still working on that. This is just some leftover stock that honestly we forgot that we even had. So
true story.
It's been there. Like, you could have come at any time between the last sale and now and gotten a mug. But we occasionally get messages from people who are like, oh, I had a mug and I dropped it and it broke. When are you going to sell them again? And we're like, oh, I don't know. Oh, anyway, they've been there the whole time. Sorry about that. So yeah. And same thing with pint glasses. If you've broken one or just want some more, when you go to ATP.fm store, you will see the mug and the pint glass at the top of the page. You also see a whole bunch of shirts. Do not buy those shirts. Those shirts are for the suckers who desperately want a shirt now and can't wait for the sale. But you know the WWDC is coming and you can wait for the WWDC sale where you will get the superior quality and more expensive shirts than we have at the WWDC sale. So don't be distracted and think, oh, this must be all the shirts they have for WWDC. It's not. That's just our on-demand shirts, which honestly, I like some of them because they're like simpler and don't have stuff on the back or whatever. But the printing process is not as fancy as the printing process that we use for the time-limited sales. So for all the people who listen to this show, you know not to buy the shirts until we tell you, hey, it's a WWDC merch sale. But the mugs and the pint glasses are exactly the same as they've always ever been. So that's what we're telling you about now.
Oh, I have some other follow-up for members of the show. This is possibly my favorite bug report I've ever gotten. We've heard from actually a few members over the last few months that if you were still using what was used to be called iTunes, now it's called the Music app on the Mac, to sync with an iPod, if you were syncing our podcast through either our bootleg or our member feeds to an iPod, it wouldn't have worked when I changed the CMS a few months back for any episode past when we started membership. So whenever that was, like 3 years ago, 2 years ago, the feed just didn't see those episodes. Only if you were syncing to an iPod. I'm happy to report that I have fixed this bug this week.
How? What was the bug?
So special thanks to member Charlie, who wrote in and was the latest person to report this. Earlier people had written in. I'm sorry, I don't have your names handy. I had just let them fall on the floor after a while of giving up. But So Charlie pointed out exactly which episode was when the cutoff was that it stopped syncing. And I took a look in the feed and I realized that was when I had changed the enclosure URLs, like the audio file name URLs that are in the feed. I had changed them when we did a CMS upgrade a few months back. And I had changed the URLs to just be like, you know, long hashes. And they did not end in .mp3. And I remember when I was looking at this, I'm like, wait a minute. I remember a long time ago, Apple used to require that podcast feeds, they used to have to end the enclosure file names in .mp3. And I think this was even undocumented. But if you didn't do that...
Wait, undocumented from Apple?
I know,
no.
Right? But, well, and I mean, and to be fair, the Apple podcast team has always documented the feed format they expect and work with. But I don't know if this detail was documented, but that was a detail back forever ago. And for some reason, that was buried in my mind. You know, that's what sticks in there. Not like, you know, birthdays, holidays, homework assignments, but that sticks in there. And so, and I really, I'm like, wait a minute. I wonder if I just add .mp3 to the end of these URLs, I bet they'll start working. And sure enough, they did. So,
cool.
So file extensions live on, much to people like John's chagrin
in the world.
File name extensions. I hate when people shorten it to file extensions because it doesn't make any sense. File name extensions. They're extensions on the file name. They're not extensions on the file.
Next, Marco's going to tell you about his ATM machine.
Yeah.
No, that's the opposite. That's adding too much information. This is removing information. File name extensions. Yeah, and that's terrible because the world is terrible and we can't have nice things because the whole world decided that they wanted to use file name extensions. And we all suffer for it. But for a brief time, I lived without them and it was glorious. I'll tell my grandchildren about it.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Also, we have some news. I genuinely, Marco did not tell us this before he brought it up on the show, so that was surprising and new for me. And then you also have some news for members in India, is that correct?
Oh, yeah. That was another whole thing. There was a very difficult to find bug in our CMS or in our payment gateway in particular that would affect cards that were verified with a thing called 3D Secure, which I think is pretty much universal in India and doesn't exist in the US. So I really didn't know about it. And this is one of those many details that Stripe, which is what we use to process our payments, pretty much handles for you. You don't really have to think about it. Except when you start customizing crap behind the scenes, which of course we can't help ourselves but do sometimes. And I had customized things behind the scenes in such a way that was breaking 3D Secure in a really difficult to find way. And some people, I don't know if it's everyone in India, but certainly multiple members who tried to sign up in India were getting an expired payment link error, and it was very, very hard to diagnose. But I eventually figured out it was through something I was doing on the back end to basically make failed payments suck less in the way they're handled, and I was being too clever, and it broke 3D Secure, and I unbroke it, so sorry.
Yep. And then as a final note, speaking of members, just a very heartfelt thank you to all of you who have ever been a member, and especially those who are currently members, and double especially for those who just recently signed up after us talking about it recently. So thank you to all of you. Our membership numbers are looking better than ever, and I'm genuinely extremely pleased and humbled and thankful for that. So thank you,
yeah,
everyone.
We
appreciate it. All right, let's do some follow-up. The WWDC lottery has come in. I can tell you that I am not a big winner.
I'm pretty sure we can safely say we all lost. Is that right?
Yep. I mean, the odds were against us, so it is what it is. No WWDC lottery winners amongst the ATP hosts, which, you know, is expected.
Yeah. Yep, unfortunately, that is
but
the
congratulations
case.
To all the winners. And honestly, indeed. We don't even want to win the lottery. We don't want to take someone else's spot. We want press passes, which
yeah,
we also
we
probably won't get. But still.
Yeah, that's what we want, but I'm not sure that's what we're getting. But
that's
a man
different lottery.
Can dream.
Yep. That's not a lottery. That is not random.
Well,
from
our point of view,
random.
It appears like a lottery. We get press things sometimes, and we are very thankful when that happens, but we have no idea when they're going to, you know, when they'll be offered, and, you know, most of the time
or
they
why,
aren't.
Really, right. Honestly, or why at all. Because yeah. When we get them, you don't ask questions. I mean, you don't get them, no one's going to tell you why, so it is what it is.
Yeah. I also wanted to, this is completely unrelated, I wanted to make a brief correction with regard to my beloved CalDigit TS4. This is the Thunderbolt 4 docking station that I've been espousing for like a year, year and a half now. I think I had made mention many, many moons ago that because of the particulars of the LG Ultra Meh 5K, I was doing a two-cable solution for my laptop. One of the cables was the CalDigit TS4. The studio display is and always has been hanging off of that. I have a few other devices hanging off of it. And then I would separately plug in the LG 5K because I was under the impression that you cannot have an LG 5K share with the CalDigit because it doesn't use display stream compression, if I remember correctly. And so it just didn't work. It had to be directly connected to the Mac. Turns out that's not right. Somebody on Mastodon, whose name I don't have in front of me, was asking for clarification on this. And I was like, no, that doesn't work. Let me just try it again. So now I am in a one cable solution for both the studio display and the LG 5K. So if you're one of the probably four people that I scared away from the CalDigit TS4, maybe not be so scared of it. It actually does work with a dual monitor setup with the studio display and the 5K. The only thing that does not work is two LG 5Ks. That apparently is too much for one connection, and that I am 100% sure does not work. But studio display and 5K is okay. So
did you double check that something hasn't changed about the thing? Like, is it not really 5K? Is it like does the bit depth go down or anything like that?
That is a completely fair question. I will say I did recently upgrade the firmware on the CalDigit, and I swear to your point that I swear I tried this at some point and it didn't work. But it very well could have been user error. It very well could be a firmware update. And it very well could be that the display, the 5K Ultramet, is not showing as much as it could or should, or maybe if I plug anything into the back of it, because if you recall, it has a couple of USB-C ports on it. Maybe if I plug something in, it'll all come crumbling down. But at least for now, I'm living the one cable blissful lifestyle where I don't plug in power. I don't plug in any monitors. I literally just plug in the CalDigit and everything else hangs off that. And it is wonderful. So just wanted to let you know. John, tell me about Apple Photos deduplication in shared libraries, if you please.
That was a feature Apple rolled out in iOS 16.4, macOS 13.3, and whatever the hell iPad. iPadOS is also on 16.4. I don't remember if they're in sync on numbers. Anyway, talked about it last episode, and I wanted to try it. So I did, and I did it in my usual cautious way. I remember I had my wife has the real photo library, and I had my own private photo library, but then I had also been manually taking everything from my phone, from my photo library, and manually importing it to hers. But I had this whole backlog of stuff in my library, some of which came from her library, because I'd take some pictures that were like the favorites from her library and put them into my library. And so when shared photo library came out, if I had just taken my entire library and shoved it into the shared library, there'd be tons of duplicates, but there was no duplicate detection. Well, now there is. So I'm like, finally, I can essentially empty my personal library, because my wife's personal library is empty. All of her photos essentially are in the shared library, and I wanted that to be the same for me. So we would have one big shared library and a very minimum of photos in our personal libraries. And to give you an idea of the only photos that I wanted to keep in my personal library were my Destiny photos. And you may be wondering what that is. It's screenshots of builds and maps, and, you know, maps with callouts written on them, and raid mechanics and pattern. Anyway, it's stuff that she doesn't want. Or no one's ever going to look at. Right? Yeah, I don't know why she wouldn't want that. And the second thing is a long series of pictures of my toes, which, if you want to know what that's about, listen to Reconcilable Differences.
No.
I had been taking pictures of my toes during various medical situations that she did not want in the shared library. And honestly, I do not blame her. So those stayed in my personal library. But anyway, I wanted to get literally everything else.
You know there's someone out there who that went from the most sexy potential thing you could have possibly said very quickly to the least sexy
Wait,
potential
Destiny?
No,
Destiny
the,
build
yes,
screenshots?
Yes, that's what I was definitely not the toes.
Okay, all right. Anyway. This feature, like, I'd read a lot about it, but, you know, this is, you know, I had tens of thousands of photos, maybe, you know, 60, 70,000. I forgot how many it was, right? Most of those were going to be unique, but there was going to be lots of duplicates, right? So I chucked a bunch in there. I just picked like 100 or so and chucked them into the library. And then you have to wait for, like, in typical Apple fashion, it's not like you could say, now please detect duplicates. No, you have to wait until it decides to detect duplicates. And the way you'll be able to tell that it has decided to detect duplicates is suddenly a duplicate photos item will appear in the sidebar. I'm doing this on the Mac, by the way. So it's a sidebar in Mac photos. You could have done it on iOS as well, but I wanted to do it on the big screen and everything. And when it finds the duplicates, you click on the duplicates, and in the Mac version of Photos, it shows basically a linear list top to bottom, and each row in the list is two photos. It shows two photos, and then underneath it two more, which is ridiculous on the Pro Display XDR because it's a huge expanse of white space to the right of it where there's nothing. But whatever. It's two by two, right? Noah's Ark. And then there's a little blue link above each set of two that says merge these two photos. Why is it not a button? Why is it a blue web link? Who freaking knows? So I'm looking at it, and I click the merge on that one, and it says like something. I think the first one was like merge these two exact duplicates, and it has some explanatory text that explains what it means. And I said yes. And then it takes the one that like it throws away one, puts it in the recently deleted folder, so it's not really like immediately deleting it. So it's still there, so you can look at it. And then it takes the other one, and like we said in the last episode, it puts it into the shared library and says, this was added to the shared library by, you know, person X and person Y. So it shows that it came from both of those places, which is great. And it's supposed to pick the highest quality copy of the photo. And so what I did before I looked at it is like, okay, let me look at this. And sometimes, you know, if when it says exact duplicate, they would be the same file size, the same resolution, like pretty exact duplicate, right? Sometimes when you click the little merge these two photos thing, it will say merge these two photos, but it wouldn't say that they were exact duplicates. In that case, one of them would be a different resolution, much smaller than the other, so on and so forth. And in that case, I would click the merge and then I would confirm, like, okay, one is 3.5 megs and one is 174K. I really want to take the 3.5 meg one, please, right? And so I'd click merge and then I'd go and confirm. You can like show, you know, show photo in all photos. And I would confirm, yes, it kept the 3.3 meg one. And then we're looking recently deleted. Okay, there's the 174K one, right? I did this sort of manually spot checking many, many, many times as I scroll, merge these two photos, you know, look at the dialogue, see what the options are, decide what I think it's supposed to do, let it do its thing, confirm that it did what I thought it was supposed to do. Sometimes it would have like two raw photos, a raw versus a JPEG. I couldn't quite tell why in some situations it would show me a raw and a JPEG and consider them duplicates. In other cases, it wouldn't. So I just basically made sure that it always did what I wanted it to do. And I did this for dozens of photos manually. And then I was like, all right, so I'm pretty sure this is working the way Apple said it would. It never made a mistake. Every time I looked at two photos, I would agree that we should only keep one of them. And I would decide which one it should be. And I would let Apple's thing do it. And it would pick the one that I thought it should. So good. Thumbs up. It's working. And it took me a little while to figure out, okay, do I have to sit here and click the little merge these two, merge these two, merge these? It was like merge these two and then hit the return key to select the default button on the dialog that appears, merge, return. Like, do I have to do that for all of them? So I glanced up to the duplicates thing and say, how many duplicates are there? And the answer was 30,000.
Oh, goodness.
So I was not going to sit there and click the blue link and click return 30,000 times, right? And so since it's a Mac, it works the way most Mac things do. You can just, you know, select all or click one and then scroll down to the end and shift click, all sorts of things that I imagine I would have a little bit more trouble doing on a phone just because of how fidgety things are with the scroll bars and the small screen and my big fat finger. So I was glad I was doing it on a Mac. But I didn't select them all first. First, I selected, you know, 1,000 and said, you know, merge these duplicates. And it did. And then I, you know, I tried to spot check the 1,000 that I picked and they all looked good. And then I did 2,000. And you know, eventually I'm like, okay, I am thoroughly satisfied that this thing is working. Select all, merge all these things. And it merged them all. And as far as I can tell, everything went off without a hitch. No, as far as I can tell, I didn't lose any photos. It didn't, you know, I went into the recently deleted thing and looked through what it had deleted. And I'm like, yeah, these look like the ones that I would want deleted. And didn't do anything weird. And I emptied my library except for toe photos and Destiny photos. You know, and actually, I actually just merged them all. And then I unmerged the toe and the Destiny ones, right? I probably unmerged them before they even synced to anybody else. So that was the easiest way to do it because I had them in folders or whatever. So thumbs up on this feature. Just like the shared photo library, I'm pretty sure it works exactly the way Apple said it would. And my only complaints continue to be the lack of features and not the features that they did add, right? So I still want shared albums and so on and so forth. But as they add the features appear to work. And I think I'm giving these things a pretty good workout with my 150, 160,000 photo library and, you know, merging 30,000 duplicates. And there was a typical kind of like, sometimes there was lag and then I went over to different computers and I saw this one still thinks there's some duplicates. So there was like one day worth of me visiting each computer and saying, do you think all the duplicates are gone? Do you think all the duplicates are gone? And occasionally a few more would pop up, but now everything has settled down. So, and during the whole time, I don't think it did anything wrong. So if you are afraid of this thing, this duplicate feature, know that at least one person has tried it and it has not been disastrous.
Yay.
Glowing recommendation.
Right. All right, so tell me about disasters with regard to your bug reports.
This is about my Anna's tracking area bug. And I said that it seemed like maybe the team that made the change was hoping they could make a change to a framework, but sort of not tell anybody about it in the hopes that, like, probably no one will notice this. And so we can just make this change. We don't have to put it in the release notes. We don't have to, you know, make a change to the documentation. We could just, you know, no one is probably relying on this existing behavior, right? And it turns out I was relying on that existing behavior. And so I, you know, wrote a bug about it. And then they had to say, oh yeah, no, the new behavior is new behavior. So here's some anonymous feedback regarding this phenomenon within Apple. This person says, I was on a team at Apple 10 years ago. You know, this is the problem with these stories. You get info from people who are willing to talk. They're willing to talk when they were at Apple 10 years ago. They're not really going to talk, you know, right now or whatever. But anyway, take it for what it's worth. I was on a team at Apple 10 years ago that worked on a tool that would ingest all iOS apps in the store nightly and run analysis to see what frameworks and methods they were using. We would frequently get asked by other teams to provide usage information of specific framework calls to see if any of the top 100 apps used them. I assume this information we use to determine the effects of removing or changing frameworks. This was 10 years ago, and I would assume they have better methods for this now. This makes me think that Apple would definitely know if Microsoft Office or Photoshop would be affected by these types of changes. So, a few things about this. First, there's lots of reasons why you would examine API usage of apps in the App Store beyond letting teams know whether they can change an API. Second, Photoshop is sold outside the App Store. I know there are versions of Photoshop inside the App Store, but like the real Photoshop is outside the App Store. And Microsoft Office, I believe, is sold both outside and inside the App Store. So I'm not entirely sure if this would let you know. But yes, Apple obviously does lots of analysis of the apps in the App Store. That's one of the advantages of running the App Store is that, and the advantage of it reviewing every application is any kind of automated thing like this of just saying like, what frameworks are popular? Who's using them? How many? We introduced the new framework at WWDC. How long does it take for that framework to start appearing in apps? Who is using it? What APIs are they using? If we made a framework, how much of the API surface is being used and by what? And especially for sort of the top 100 apps, like, you know, the apps that we really care about. I don't know how they even determine top 100 apps. It's all casino games for children at this point. So I'm not sure how, like how representative that is of what APIs they should work on. But yeah, I do think Apple has good visibility into that. But of course, Apple being Apple, the team making changes to the framework has to ask some other team, the, you know, whatever, the API usage App Store analysis team to find out. And of course, my API in question was on the Mac. And so they have to ask about the Mac App Store. And I think the top 10 apps in the Mac App Store are probably not representative of the top 10 apps used by Mac users. And so there's a little bit more difficulty there. But anyway, there's one take from the inside on Apple's, you know, unsurprising awareness and analysis of the software that passes through their ecosystem.
We also got some feedback from another anonymous person, which indicates that maybe the radar grass is not actually greener on the other side. I'm going to read most of it. I work for a big developer in the games industry, and we definitely get a very different support experience from Apple, though I'm not sure the outcomes are any different. At the corporate level, which is way above my level, we have whole teams of developer relationships people from Apple talking to our first-party relationships people about business deals or whatever. I have only the tiniest insight into this, and I can't share it. My team is direct contact with someone in Apple Developer Relations and several engineers that work with them. We have monthly meetings between our engineers and this team in which we raise issues, ask for advice, etc. We also have a private Slack channel with that same DevRel team where we can raise issues and get a response at any time. It seems like this should be great, right? Right? But we end up with broadly the same frustrations. Da-da-da-da. Wow. Responses to our bug reports are slow. Granted, less slow because we have more ability to nag them about it. We continually have to prod the Slack thread and ask, what's happening with this issue? We see the, we think we've fixed it, or try in the latest beta responses from Apple, but they haven't fixed it. And it's still difficult to figure out which beta that will supposedly have the fix. They still can't share any details of how things work under the hood to help us come up with viable workarounds, which in some cases we would need even if the bugs were fixed because we want to support a broader range of OS versions. They often can't answer straightforward questions like, what are the performance implications of X versus Y? Either because they don't know, can't say, or it depends, and they can't tell us on what. I guess my point is it isn't just the feedback radar system itself that's the problem. Apple's organization seems to be set up with such a focus on secrecy that they just can't provide the transparency that you need as an external developer to really believe that they do actually care about and are working on your problems. I'm going to read it again because I think it's that good. Apple's organization seems to be set up with such a focus on secrecy that they just can't provide the transparency that you need as an external developer to really believe that they do actually care about and are working on your problems. Amen to that.
Wow. That was just framed as, our deal for us is different when we're at a big company, but the outcomes are the same. But how much would you kill for a private Slack channel with Apple engineers so you could prod them in threads? Like, I know they are held back by being unresponsive and, you know, like, oh, they can't tell you. And like, yeah, it is frustrating. It is worse than I think what they'd be comparing it to is, say you're a big, important company. Big, important company would get better support from, say, Microsoft than they get from Apple, you know, for right. We're not expecting that dinky little developers will get the same support as a big giant company. I think what they're coming from, where they come from here, is we are a big important company, so we know how big and important companies get treated by different platform owners, and Apple is the worst, right? Because of secrecy, because they can't tell us things, and because they're unresponsive, and because, you know, there's layers, you know, that the organization is not set up to be responsive to demand. So as jealous as we are as individual developers of having these kind of touch points, it's unrealistic to assume that any individual developer would have this. But in within each sort of, you know, cohort, within each strata of developers, it seems like if you were to compare like to like, big company, how do you get support from Apple versus how you get it from Microsoft versus how you get it from Google? Apple is always in last place, seemingly for structural and secrecy reasons.
Yeah.
Sad times. All right. And thus we enter the camera portion of the show, which begins in follow up, but we'll continue into the main topic. I believe this is all Marco. Is that correct?
It's certainly a lot me. although I'm sure John will jump in, and I hope he does, because there's going to be a lot. all right. So I talked last time about, a few times ago, but I asked for more time because I needed it. So I gone through my brief camera buying phase of the 5-year span that we're in, because that's about as often as I buy cameras. And it's a pattern. I recognize it at this point. You know, about every 5 years, I see what modern cameras can do. It blows me away. I buy one or two modern cameras, and then over the next few years, I stop using them because they're too much to carry around. iPhones get better and more convenient, and I say, I'm never going to buy a camera again. And then what inevitably happens is, you know, a few years later, the cycle repeats as cameras get better.
Has this cycle repeated that much? I think you may be on the first round of this particular cycle, because I think you were like, big cameras are good, I'm into big cameras, and then the iPhone camera got good, and then you switched all iPhone. I think this is your first backslide, unless I'm remembering it different.
No, that sounds right.
I think this is the first loop. I mean, I agree with you that it's probably going to repeat, because let history be a guide. There are the cycles of Marco. But I think to be fair to you, this is your first time through this.
Maybe my first. It's certainly my first time in, you know, a while, in about 5 years. I guess there was my brief flirtation with being a videographer or a vlogger or video producer, where I bought a couple of, you know, objects for video production, never used them, and eventually mailed them to you.
You made some videos. You actually made videos with them, right?
I think I made a video, and it wasn't
very
good.
You had like a Mac Mini video and some other thing. Something.
And the
anyway.
iPad, the iPad Pro 2018. That was it. And that was the same. I'm pretty sure that was the same. Was it the same season? It doesn't matter. I think it was the same event.
But in that one, I don't think you had a period where you were like, big video cameras are crappy, you should just use your iPhone for everything.
Yeah. But anyway, so as usual during this phase, I was trying to figure out, how do I make my new cool camera as convenient as the iPhone? And of course, that's impossible. But I ran into a couple of issues. Number one was, I was torn between the physical size of the Ricoh GR3X, which is awesome. But I was not super thrilled with the color of its pictures. And then I was very impressed by the Fujifilm X100V, but it was a little bit less technically easy to use and technically sharp as the Ricoh GR3X. But the Fuji-produced pictures that I just loved the colors from. And so got a bunch of feedback on this. So first of all, a number of people sent in this website. It's RicoRecipes.com. This is Richie's Ricoh Recipes. And the Ricoh has these various customization options where you can set, all right, for custom mode number 2, set, you know, color plus 2, saturation minus 1, sharpness plus 1, that kind of thing. And so what this person, Richie, has done is made a whole bunch of kind of presets for those settings that you can enter into your camera to achieve different looks. And the idea is to get much of the same benefit as Fuji's film emulation modes, which you know, are very appealing and very popular with Ricoh cameras. And I tried them, and they are better than the Ricoh's defaults, but I was not able to find one that I really thought was comparable to what I was getting out of the Fuji with no effort whatsoever. So it seems like if what you want is really cool colors in the photos, and if you like the way Fuji's render color, as far as I can tell, there is no direct substitution in camera hardware. Now, you can get like Lightroom presets and stuff that people have made to try to emulate Fuji's modes, and they might come closer. But I have not yet found anything that offers what Fuji does in like in-camera JPEG processing, so you can just dump it right onto something and use it immediately. So that's that. On the Fuji itself, I had talked about how crappy all the camera apps are about transferring photos over Wi-Fi to your phone or whatever, like all these different schemes everyone has, and they're all crappy and terrible and slow. And I learned that Fuji has this feature called PC autosave, and I assume it's how you pronounce it because it's in all capitals.
PC load letter. What the F does that mean?
Or retry fail.
There you go.
Just pull out all the old PC tropes where everything was in caps.
Yeah. So anyway, PC autosave is on most Fuji cameras, at least you know most reasonably modern ones. Although it's funny, I decided in the intervening time to cancel my return for the X-T5. I kept the X-T5 and I love it. And shut up. So the PC autosave is on the X100V and many other modern Fuji cameras, and it's on the X-T3 and 4, I think. For some reason, I don't think it's on the X-T5. I can't find it anywhere, and it's not on the compatibility list, and it's not in the instruction manual, and I can't find it anywhere in the menus. So,
did you do a firmware update?
Yes, I did. It's the running the modern version of everything. Thank you for... Mm-hmm. John, you were the one who taught me that camera firmware updates exist. That's the first thing I tried. Like, oh, maybe I got, you know, an early version, and it didn't help, and it's listed nowhere, it's documented nowhere, it's not in the instructions, so I'm pretty sure it just doesn't have this feature for some reason. But anyway, what PC autosave is you run this horrendous little Fuji app on your Mac or PC or whatever, and you set up the camera, you kind of pair the camera to this app on your computer that's always running in your menu bar with a hideous icon and an even more hideous interface, and you can tell the camera... From its playback mode, you can go to the playback menu and select PC autosave, and it will then begin to very slowly connect to your Wi-Fi network, find your PC, and then very slowly automatically save the pictures to it over your Wi-Fi network. And it is a comically slow process, but it does work. So if you happen to have your computer on the same Wi-Fi network as your camera, this method is a little bit less horrible than using the apps to transfer. But ultimately, all of these methods are so much more horrible than just plugging the camera directly into your computer or popping the card out and using a card reader. You're better off just doing that. And I think I would expect once the iPhone goes USB-C, I would imagine you will probably be able to just plug in any USB-C card reader to the iPhone, and I bet it'll import it directly. Because right now, I Apple has sold various camera connection kit accessories over the years. Some of which have USB ports, some of which just have SD card slots. I believe the ones of those that use the Lightning port, I think, do already work on the iPhone, but I'm not positive about that. I don't have one here to test, and I wasn't going to buy one a few months before the USB-C iPhone comes out, so I could be wrong on that. But anyway, that's an option maybe to go directly to a phone. I know it at least works on iPads and definitely works on Macs. So that's the way to go if you want to transfer photos to your cool Apple hardware, is just dump them onto the computer directly with the card or the cable. Also got a wonderful tip. My complaint about the X100V was I was having trouble getting the autofocus to really nail the focus, like especially on eyes. It would sometimes focus on the the tip of the eyelashes instead of the actual eye surface, stuff like that. Like it was like slightly missing focus a lot, and I was having trouble getting sharp shots. So Anonymous wrote in to say that the X100V ships with the release/focus priority setting on shutter, meaning it will prioritize taking a picture over actually getting the right focus. Changing it to focus improved my hit rate noticeably and seems to have little impact on shutter lag in most situations. So to explain this, basically almost every modern camera, at least in default mode, usually if you push the shutter button but the lens has not focused yet, usually it will wait until it locks on focus and then take the picture. So that's shutter lag. And sometimes it's really frustrating if you're maybe in the dark and the camera's having trouble focusing and you're like, just push it, just take it. And the camera's going back and forth and can't really focus on something. So oftentimes this feature, in more pro modes or more pro models, will be set to shutter priority, which means as soon as you hit the shutter button all the way down, just take the picture, regardless of whether the autofocus engine thinks it has focus or not. And so the EX100V ships in that mode by default, where it just takes the picture, even if it's not focused all the way. So I changed this, the way Anonymous said, to change it to focus priority. So the former, where it waits for focus, even if it introduces some lag before it actually takes the picture. And I agree. It seems to have improved the hit rate, and it does not seem to introduce noticeable lag in any situation I've encountered so far.
Are you not a fan of back button focusing, which would also solve this problem for you?
Like the AF on button on Canons and stuff like that, like where like you hit the button there without, because normally I just half press the shutter and then go all the
right
way.
Right. You know? So most people, big cameras ship so that if you press the shutter button halfway down, it will start focusing. And then if you press it the rest of the way down, it will take the picture. And at that point, everything you just described takes place. It says, should I really take the picture, or should I wait for the focusing motor to finish getting to where I know it's supposed to focus, and so on and so forth, right? The other technique is often called back button focusing, which means you assign some button on the back of your camera to be the please do autofocus now button. And then the shutter button and you turn off the feature that makes the camera try to focus when you push the shutter button halfway down. So you separated the two functions. So you decide when you want your camera to do autofocusing with the back button. And then once you're happy with the focus, you can press the shutter button. You can do both of them at the same time, and then you would still have the same situation where, should I wait for the motor or whatever? But you could also do your focus, and then once you're happy, yes, you've got the focus to my satisfaction, and the thing isn't moving, the person isn't moving or whatever. Then when you press the shutter button, it's going to take it immediately, because no part of pressing the shutter button tells it to do focus again. Focusing is separated from shutter. I am not a big fan of this, but I see the situations where it could be advantageous. And some people, this is the only way they use the camera, and they consider it broken to use the other way. But I feel like it's just kind of a muscle memory type thing a lot of the times. But you see the advantages, like, if you get it focused on somebody and they're not moving, very often with cameras, with modern cameras being so good at focusing on stuff, like someone in the background will move and turn their head towards the camera, and the camera will be like, ooh, a pair of eyes. I'm totally going to focus on that. It's like, no, focus on the ear of the person I just focused on. Like, if you get the focus the way you want and the person you focus on turns their head away, so now their ear is facing you, but you're happy with that focal plane. You don't want it to jump to the person in the background whose two eyes just face there. You want it to stay where you left it. And so in that situation, you do back button focusing to get the focus you want. So you get perfect eye focus on that person. And even if they turn their head slightly, you don't want it to pick some other subject. So then you use the shutter button for it. So if you got used to that technique of focusing, I think that would essentially do the same thing as you saying shutter priority, because in that case, the shutter never activates autofocus. It just fires the shutter.
Yeah, I never shot that style, but it's a lot of people do. So there's probably some. I probably should be using that style.
It's more cumbersome a lot of the time, and especially if you forget that you previously selected this focal plane, and I'm never going to change it unless you hit the back button again. And you think, because you get used to just using the half focus. The other way to solve this problem with lag or maybe missing the focus is to get a Sony camera or some other camera that has insanely good, really really fast, really smart focus selection that's just been getting better and better over time. And to be fair, all camera manufacturers have been getting better and better. Sony used to have a huge lead, and now it just has a smaller lead. But Sony still is a really good focusing system where it will, like, the reason you don't notice it on Sony's is it's so fast. First of all, Sony lenses are very fast to physically focus. And second, the Sony, like, image detection system is really good at finding the thing you want to focus on and tracking it and not getting distracted when something moves. So that's one of the advantages of the Sony cameras, but other ones have been catching up, and these type of settings are a good way to sort of shore up the minor inefficiencies as compared to the best of the best.
Yeah. And in all fairness, as much as I love the Fuji color processing, they are not close to class leading with, like, autofocus sophistication. That is one area where they are, I think, behind the competitors. And I think all the reviews agree with that. So I have noticed that it is not as smart as Sony's autofocus, but it's smart enough for me, and I'm loving the pictures that it's getting. It's like, if I was a sports photographer, I would definitely not use Fuji, but I would. But for taking pictures that I like a lot in other situations, it's proving to be fantastic. One thing I noticed as I was taking pictures with these cameras for the first time, since using an iPhone, I noticed that I missed the iPhone HDR photography. And I don't mean the so cameras have caught up in a number of ways. So since I you know, the previous last camera I bought was the Sony a7 R3, which is at this point probably something like 5 years old, in that ballpark. And what cameras have gotten really good at eating away some of the iPhone's advantages in the meantime. Not all of them, and they never will get all of them, but some of them. And one of the things is, you know, the iPhones have always been really, not always, but modern iPhones have always been really good at dealing with high dynamic range scenes. Scenes where you have something very bright, like maybe something, you know, water reflecting the sun or the actual sun or the moon or something, you know, in your shot, something very bright, but you still want to have detail in the darker shadow areas. So, you know, you have to have a lot of dynamic range in the image. And modern camera sensors in big cameras can capture that dynamic range very well. Modern camera sensors have incredible dynamic range, but usually where they lacked is in processing down that dynamic range to a useful photo that you would actually want and look good without losing all the details in the highlights or the shadows. And usually you had to shoot raw to really make the most of that. I am so done shooting raw. Like, the pictures are so huge and they break in everything. And I'm just not. And that's for a more editing focused workflow than what I want.
You might be back to the raw eventually, but I think so. This is relevant to a link that we'll put in the show notes from Petapixel that is actually from today, no, 2 days ago, where the headline is Gen Z discovers modern digital cameras are better than iPhones, and it shows a bunch of pictures on like TikTok where they're like, look, you know, this person was sitting on the beach and we want to take a picture of them. Here's what it looks like on the iPhone. Here's what it looks like on a real camera. And there's situations in which the iPhone sensor is too small to gather enough light and the real camera like is able to gather enough light to correctly expose the person, right? But a lot of these pictures, like, oh, look how dark everything is in the iPhone. I think they're terrible examples because what you just said is so true. Where the iPhone excels is not being like good at low light photography and that it gathers lots of light on the sensor and can sort of see in the dark. No. That's not why the iPhone photos come out well. They come out well because it does the high dynamic HDR photos, meaning, and we're setting aside what you're going to get to eventually, right, with just the EDR stuff. But like when the iPhone does high dynamic range, it does it in the same way that big cameras can do it, but it does it without involving the user at all. You just press the shutter button on the iPhone. And what the iPhone does, it's not like, oh, it processes its dynamic range better. It takes multiple exposures. Right. It doesn't. It takes one underexposed. It takes one overexposed. I don't know how many exposures it takes. It takes at least two, maybe more. And it combines them. So it's not a single photo because a single photo has crap dynamic range on a sensor that's like the size of the end of an eraser on a pencil. Right. Going through this tiny little lens with this tiny little, it's just, there's not a lot of light there. So why do the iPhone cameras actually look better? Where is the real camera pictures? Not because it takes multiple exposures and combines them. If you take a single exposure with a full frame camera in a very challenging lighting situation, like a person with a bright sunset behind them, you can choose to expose so the sunset is not blown out and then the person is all dark. You can choose to expose the person so their skin tone looks good and then the sky behind them is blown out. With any single exposure, you can try to get as much, you know, big camera sensors have a lot of dynamic range. You can try to get a compromise between them, but in very challenging situation where there's a really bright light behind somebody, you can't have both. But big cameras can also take multiple exposures and try to combine them. They're so much worse at it than phones, right? Because first of all, there's the contract when you're using a big camera, which is you press the shutter button, we do a single exposure. Oh, do you want to do exposure bracketing? Well, that's a setting and you get to do it. And maybe you want to use electronic shutter, or maybe we're going to take multiple ones. And I hope you don't shake the camera because our software is not very good at aligning the pictures and combining them. The iPhone totally wins there. So I feel like this Petapixel article is showing a bunch of photos where I'm like, the iPhone probably would do better here unless you're in a situation that is within the realm of the dynamic range of a real camera that you don't need. If you have a big sensor and a real camera, you don't need to do multiple exposures, whereas the iPhone does need to do multiple exposures and it ends up looking worse. And I guess that's what their examples are here. But I think, you know, you've said in the past, Marco, like, you know, iPhones are better at low light. And then we get all this feedback saying, are you crazy? iPhones aren't better at low light. They have a tiny sensor. They can't gather any light or whatever. And it's like, no, they're not better physically speaking in terms of photons, but they're better because they take, you know, one, they take two or more exposures. I honestly don't know how many they take, and they find a way to combine them, even if your hand is shaking, even if, you know, like they the processing of the multiple exposures that they take, exposing for the sky, exposing for the person's face, exposing for this, and then they do all this processing, and they mush it up into this thing that they call a photo, which is a combination of multiple photos. That's what they're better at. And big cameras can do that, but it's a setting, and you have to know how to use it, and they're still not as good at doing the combination of those exposures as Apple is, let alone doing them seamlessly when you just press a single shutter button. Maybe they'll get there someday, but I do kind of feel like there is that implied contract with a real camera, which is you press that shutter button once, we do one exposure. And if you want something different, you have to ask for it explicitly.
Well, and there is an HDR mode on the X-T5. I got to see if the X100V has it. But
you're talking about multiple exposures, or are you talking about, the thing where we add a brightness channel that shows the bright stuff brighter?
So there's multiple options. So there is the multiple exposure thing. You flip a knob over to HDR. It's right at your thumb. You hit the shutter, and it goes, boop, 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 and it takes three pictures, and it merges them, and you get a JPEG out, and it's done. That's using the exposure bracketing, you know, one dark, one light, one medium, different settings for like, you know, how much range you want to cover there, how much you want to, you know, crush into the final picture. But then modern cameras also have usually some form of extended dynamic range shooting mode. So what this and the various details of how they do this are, you know, they vary by manufacturer and everything. Some of them will have like dynamic range priority modes. But the idea basically is they use a larger range, like they capture a larger range than they normally would, and then map that to like, you know, the 0 to 1 color space, you know, for the JPEG. So what ends up happening is it looks, you know, if you've seen HDR pictures online, like they can look a little bit odd, it like in terms of like the contrast is maybe too low and everything kind of looks almost like a painting, like not texture wise but like color wise.
Again, I feel like we need to distinguish. You're talking about HDR with multiple exposures?
No, one exposure.
All right, so then what you're talking about is if you take a photo with your iPhone, for example, of a sunset, you may notice that when you view that on your iPhone with an HDR screen, that the sun looks brighter.
That's different. So there's three different things. All right, so all right. I'm talking about like extended dynamic range modes on big cameras, where they use the range they have differently. They map it differently to capture more range at the expense of usually contrast and possibly noise, because it's kind of like they kind of like shoot at a higher ISO than they would need to, and then kind of capture the. I don't know the details of how it works, but
Speaking of details, I should find this in the show notes in a future show. I actually had it in the notes. I learned something recently. We're watching a video about Sony cameras, ISO in particular. You probably already knew this, and maybe we even mentioned it on a past show, but if we did, I totally forgot it. That Sony's sensors on their cameras have two different capture modes, essentially, depending on what ISO level they're at. There's like a low sensitivity one and a high sensitivity one. And when you cross an ISO threshold, which differs from camera to camera, it kicks into the other mode, which I had no idea about, but it explains so much. If you look at the test results, you can say, I can see. And on this camera at ISO 400, it switches to the other thing, which is, you know, it's a trade-off between dynamic range and noise and stuff like that. But it's something that Sony doesn't really mention because they don't consider it to be a feature that you can count on. I forget what the term of art is, but their video cameras do it explicitly, and they only talk about it there because the video cameras are able to be equally good in both of the ranges. But it explains a lot if you have a Sony camera, of like why when I was cranking up the ISO everything kept looking worse and worse until I crossed the threshold and all of a sudden it got better and then started on a whole new curve. It's because these sensors have two different modes. It makes sense when you see the underlying stuff. I'll try to find it for a future episode, or maybe even for this one, but it was fascinating. And that's the type of technical detail that is buried inside your cameras that is good to know, because on a real camera, you have control over that stuff. On the iPhone, even if you're using a third-party camera app and tweaking all the settings, not quite as much control.
Yeah. And so rounding out the dynamic range topic, one of the things I missed also was what John said a minute ago. When you take a picture with a modern iPhone of a high dynamic range environment, like there's a sunset or something, you notice when you view it, it cranks the brightness up way past normal, like, you know, pure white brightness levels for those parts of the photo that are super bright, like the tips of the waves, the sun, you know, the light in the background, the moon, whatever it is. Those get higher brightness levels. Same thing happens in any kind of modern Mac with do they call them EDR or HDR for the screens? They call them XDR.
It's called EDR, I think, is what they call the technology of, hey, we're going to show your screen the way we normally do, but if you show one of those photos that was taken how you describe, we will also show that on the same screen without changing your display mode or anything like that. That's the EDR. It's like the ability to combine regular dynamic range, your windows and, you know, web pages and stuff like that. But oh, here, this little square of it is high dynamic range, just that little square. We've talked about it before with like the aerial screensaver, when you show a preview of it in like system settings or whatever, that it's like this little tiny window that's suddenly HDR, but the whole rest of your screen is normal.
Exactly. And so when you view these photos taken, when you view them on an you know, HDR compatible screen from Apple, so, you know, the modern, at least the Pro phones, all the modern Pro phones, maybe some of the non-Pro ones, and then of course Pro Display XDR, any modern MacBook Pro, and I think that's it. You know, so I was wondering, well, if I'm using a camera that can capture all this dynamic range, how can I get my pictures to render in that mode on my Pro Display XDR or my MacBook Pro? And, you know, because it's obviously just some kind of metadata somewhere, like, how do I set that? So I was looking for an app that can do this, that can be like, all right, take this photo from my camera, turn on EDR display mode for it, and then let me map, you know, in the image, like, all right, what levels correspond to what? So, you know, because what EDR, the way EDR works, basically, is it allows, you know, if your regular screen brightness is like 0.0 to 1.0, EDR would be like, all right, in this photo, we have some areas that are 1.5 bright. So, you know, map what the photo has from, you know, 0 to 1, map it really to 0 to 1.5 and show that way on the screen. So there's a way you can, you know, map the brightness levels and the tone levels from the picture onto a different range for display on the screen. So this is, it's all just metadata.
Did you look up how the iPhone does this?
No, I didn't have time for that.
So I believe my vague recollection that the way Apple decided to do exactly what you're describing, they wanted to do it in a way so that when you share that photo with somebody who doesn't have an HDR screen, like they just have a regular, they have a MacBook Air or they have an iMac 24 inch or something like that, and they don't have an HDR screen, that it still looks normal to them, like that nothing goes wonky. So my vague recollection is that what Apple did is, it's, you know, the JPEG or whatever, the HEIC image is just the regular dynamic range. And then there's a separate, sort of a separate channel that's like the brightness enhancing channel.
Oh, yeah.
And non-HDR screens will just ignore that channel and just show it normal. But if you have an HDR screen, it takes like the brightness channel and smushes it together with the picture and then produces the output. What you're describing sounds more like you've got the image data and then you're just like telling it to reinterpret it. But I do wonder if the Fuji thing is doing the, you know, separating the brightness channel from the regular image for backup compatibility reasons, or if it's really just like baking it into the photo and then just reinterpreting it according to some flag that says, hey, when you look at this thing, interpret it this way.
Well, so as far as I can tell, I don't think any modern standalone cameras shoot that way with that, whatever that metadata is that makes Apple display them super bright. I don't think any modern cameras do that. So I was wondering, how can I apply that in editing? Like, is there some app that can toggle that flag and generate that brightness data for my pictures? And I looked around. So I have Pixelmator. So Pixelmator on the Mac can do it. If you go to the color adjustment section, hit customize, you can add an EDR toggle. The problem is this only works for RAW files, as far as I can tell. And it seems like the X-T5 RAW files are supported by nothing right now, including not Pixelmator, not Mac Photos. Like, nothing seems to support the X-T5 RAW files, even though this camera came out like last fall, I think. It's not super new, but anyway. So Pixelmator on the Mac can do it only for RAW files. Pixelmator Photo is their iOS app. This can do it for all files. If you go to the adjustment sliders, hit the ellipsis menu, and then there's an option that says turn on EDR. So that's what it's called EDR in Pixelmator, and so that's what you want to turn on if you want to play with this. I separately found an app called Radiance Plus. I'll link to it. It's $3 a month or $30 lifetime, and I converted two photos with it and instantly paid the $30 lifetime fee. It's a very, very simple app. It just has like two sliders. It's like, you know, brightness and strength or something like that. And I converted these two pictures I had taken with the Fuji X100V, or no, one's X100V, one is X-T5. And I will link to them in the show notes. and you can see it's they look awesome. And these pictures were awesome by themselves, like before I did this, but they're even more awesome when I added this flag. They just look fantastic, and it much better captures the actual range that the scene actually looked like. And I'm very, very happy that I can basically take awesome camera input and make them look as nice as the iPhone photos do in this particular way. And then that syncs. You know, I added them to my library. Like, it works in your photo library. And so now those show up on all my devices in that cool EDR mode, and it looks great. So I will link to these apps in the show notes. If you want to do it, I strongly recommend giving these apps a try.
That's good. That's really awesome. I didn't realize you could do that.
Did you? I know you uploaded some of these photos for me and Casey to look at. I'm wondering if something happened to them when you uploaded them, because I'm looking at it on my XDR now and they don't look HDR-y.
It's a pretty subtle effect. In the sunset one, the sun is the bright part and the sky is a little bit brighter.
I know. I guess I'm expecting them to look like the Apple ones with a separate brightness channel where it is very noticeable that it's happening. And here I mean, they look good. They don't look bad, but I don't see that effect like the Apple thing has in the brightness channel.
Well, in both of these sample images, I've done a fairly conservative application of it because I didn't want it to look like totally outrageous. That's just not my style. But it's just like it's like a nice little. It's like adding salt to a meal, like a little bit. Like, this looks a little bit nicer. And if you see it side by side without it, it's a more obvious difference.
Yeah, that's what you should. You should have put up the ones that had this turned off, so I could do a B comparison to them.
Yeah, I'll get to that someday. All right. So while I was doing all this, I was in camera mode, and so one of the most common times that we use big cameras in our household is. We can occasionally see some wildlife from our deck of our house. And so I wanted something that had a big zoom. And I gave Tiff as a gift a couple years ago. I gave her a super zoom lens for our Sony, the 200 to 600 millimeter Sony zoom with a 2x teleconverter so that it reaches to 1200 millimeters. It's a very far reach. And we've tried to shoot with this a lot. We haven't had great success with it, in part because it's just not a very sharp lens. So we've gotten some pictures that just were very soft and very low contrast. And I thought at first maybe that's just the teleconverter. So I took the teleconverter off, less reach, faster, etc. And it just still was not very good. And some of it is just distance. You know, if we're taking pictures of something that's like, you know, very, very far away, the atmospheric haze, you know, the water vapor in the air, like it makes it hard to capture anything very sharp at a very great distance because that's just how air works and you can't really get around that. you can put the UV filter on it and everything. That doesn't really do much. It's not really, you know, you're dealing with the atmosphere. So there's only so much you can do. But I was curious, now that I was in the Fuji system, Fuji has a similar reach lens, and I also know that there's this whole category of super zoom cameras, and I had never tried one before. I know John has occasionally tried things like this, right?
Yeah, before I got interchangeable lens cameras, I went from like little handheld, like, you know, point and shoot type things, which are my first digital cameras, to super zooms, which I used for many years, because what you get with a super zoom, I remember I was taking pictures of my kids playing in the waves in the water, is you get a really good quality, incredibly long zoom lens for the price of never being able to take it off your camera, because it's not an interchangeable lens camera. It is a camera. It comes with this built in and it is what it is. And I was able to get, I think my last one that I got was like, it was like, 2.8 aperture through the entire zoom range, which is absolutely unheard of unless you're willing to spend like thousands of dollars on a like interchangeable lens zoom thing. Because normally you're lucky if the lowest end of the zoom range is f2.8. Usually it starts off much worse than that and gets worse as you zoom. But I was able to get for a very low price a tiny sensor in a not very, you know, good camera, but it comes built in with a extremely long zoom that's f2.8 through the whole aperture range. Like, there's no, if I had to try to get that in a quote unquote real camera equivalent, it would have cost like thousands of dollars more. So I endorse that type of camera and they're really cool, but of course that's all you're getting. Like, there's no, you can't put a prime lens on it, you know. It's not, the sensors tend not to be very big. And if you do get one with a big sensor or whatever, then those also cost thousands of dollars. But it is a very inexpensive way to get a really good quality, really long zoom, as long as you're okay with that being the only thing this camera can do.
Yeah, and usually, you know, there's other compromises that are made there. You know, usually it's you know, it might not have the best optical quality. Usually the sensor is substantially smaller than you would get in like a big camera. Resolution usually not as good. It doesn't have as many pro features. Like, you know, there's other downsides to it, but overall, it's you know, super zooms can be pretty good. And so I was curious.
And also, the super zooms are almost always way, way, way smaller than an equivalent focal length range would be on like a full frame camera or something. Like smaller, lighter, like some of them are comical. Like you put this picture up, some of the biggest super zooms do get comical, but they're still smaller. They're still smaller than if you were to get that same focal length, smaller, lighter, if you get that same focal length in an interchangeable lens. So it is, I love that category because it's like, we're going to make compromises in it for the sake of having really good zoom and not being so big that you need like an extra person to hold the front of the lens up for you.
Yeah. So here, I just pasted this link. I'll make this the image of the chapter art. This is all the different cameras. And so I don't own most of these. I went to Lens Rentals and I rented a whole bunch of stuff from them because I'm like, I want to try out modern super zooms to see how good are they? How do they compare to the Sony super zoom that we have? And do I want to maybe, you know, sell the Sony thing and buy something else.
And by the way, are you calling the Sony thing a super zoom? I think super zoom only applies to the cameras that don't have interchangeable lenses and have really long zoom.
No, I know.
And the other ones are just called...
I'm just talking about a giant telephoto lens.
Yes, exactly.
I consider the combined unit of the camera and the giant telephoto lens, I will call that a super zoom. I know it's technically not. There's other things in here that also aren't super zooms, but I'll explain why in a minute. But anyway, so decided to rent all this stuff to see, like, how do I like modern, you know, long reach camera options. How do they compare to my giant Sony full frame, you know, 600 millimeter telephoto? Like, how does all this stuff compare? And maybe does something else fit my needs better? Or maybe I could, you know, trade the Sony for it, you know, with B&H or something like that. So anyway, I rent all the stuff from Lens Rentals. They were great as usual. I also wanted to try with all this. So I rented what seemed to be, according to DP Review, which is I've been on that site so much recently, and I'm still so sad it's going away. But anyway, I went to their reviews and ratings and everything, and did some research and found it seemed like the two generally best regarded super zooms right now are the Sony RX10 Mark IV and the Nikon Coolpix P1000, and both of the Nikon is about $1,000. The Sony RX10's almost $2,000. So it's a pretty big price difference. The Sony only, quote, only goes to an equivalent of 600 millimeters. So it's not a massive reach, but that is still pretty far. You know, especially for something that is as small as it is. And if you look at this picture of the overview of all these cameras, the Sony RX10 is the one in the bottom left corner. And it's, you can see it is way smaller than the telephoto cameras, than the full frame telephotos. And it's even significantly smaller than the next one to its right. That's that other black camera is the Nikon P1000. But the P1000 doesn't just go to 600 millimeters. It goes to 3000 millimeters. Yes. So the P1000.
I also want to point out, and if you're looking at this photo, which you should be, it'll be the chapter art and it'll probably also be in the show notes, that when Marco says the one in the lower left corner, it goes to 600 millimeters, that's how far at least one of the white ones on the right goes.
Yes.
So compare...
The one
like,
on the far right is the same.
Yeah, the far right lens has the same zoom distance as the far left camera. So when we say you save size and weight by going with the super zoom, this is what we mean.
Yeah. Oh, and in all fairness, I did have the lens hoods attached to the two to everything.
But you should. There's a lens hood on the one on the left too.
Yes. You really should for, you know, when you're trying to minimize, you know, any kind of thing that could cause haziness and trying to maximize contrast, you want the lens hoods on.
I think the lens hood on the camera on the right is bigger than the entire camera on the left.
I think you're right. Yeah. So anyway, so. And I also, you'll note right above the Nikon P1000 is a little tiny black camera. That is the Sony RX100 Mark VII. This is not a super zoom, but the reason I rented the RX100, first of all, it's very inexpensive to rent. I'm like, I'm already renting all this other stuff. Let me throw this in too. I've wanted to try it. The RX100 series, I first rented it from Lens Rentals, actually, back in 2013. I rented the very first one, and now they're on Mark 7. Unfortunately, Mark 7 seems to be, this might be the last one. Like, they released this Mark 7 in 2019, and there's been like nothing on that front since. But what's interesting about it is that it's kind of pocketable. Not really, you know, you wouldn't want this in your pocket. A jacket pocket you could do. Definitely not like a pants or, you know, other clothing pocket. But you could easily put it in pretty much any size bag and larger jackets. So, and, you know, backpacks for sure, you know, definitely. So I was interested in the RX100, the new one, because I had heard it had gotten a lot better since the one I had tried in 2013. And the one in 2013 was pretty underwhelming in terms of image quality. But it is, the RX100 series is you know, very small, and it has a zoom range of something like 24 to 70 equivalent. No, sorry, 24 to 200 equivalent. My mistake. There is one that's 24 to 70. That's the one that ends in A. It's not this one. So anyway, 24 to 200 roughly equivalent. And so I thought, that's really interesting to be in that size. How good could the optics possibly be in that? And I saw sample pictures on dpreview.com, and I was like, that seems impossible. Like, that they look pretty good for a camera that's that size, has like a little, I think it's like a 1-inch sensor, like a little, you know, still bigger than a phone by a mile, but, you know, still a small sensor for a standalone camera, and these little tiny optics that go to 200 millimeter. How good could that possibly be? But the reviews were stellar. So I thought, let me rent this thing. You know, I think it was like $60 to rent. I'm like, fine, let me rent it. I want to try this. And so I rented that as well. And my thinking there was, what I'm kind of looking for here is, where big cameras can still very much shine is areas that the iPhone really cannot compete in. And one of those areas is long reach. Now, we will see. I know this fall there's the rumors of the Pro Max phone having the periscope arrangement of its optics, which would almost certainly result in a much better zoom reach. But I would be surprised if it was competitive with anything else here, frankly. So I decided, let me see something that is approximately, you know, pocketable-ish, almost size class. Let me see its reach as a competitor to a phone. I was thinking, if I really love this little tiny Sony camera, maybe I would buy one and just kind of keep it in my backpack wherever I go and occasionally use it, because that can cover roles that the iPhone really can't cover. And sometimes I want that. So anyway, rented all this stuff and I tried it all out, and I made a little sample gallery. I will link to that in the show notes as well. And found out a couple of, I think, useful comparison points. I'll try to be quick. I know it's not super entertaining listening to a podcast about photos, but I'll try to be quick. What surprised me the most, so I went outside and I tried to take the same approximate set of pictures with all of these cameras at, you know, when possible, at the same focal lengths, and just kind of compare to see, how are they in handling? What kind of quality am I getting? What kind of, you know, sharpness and stabilization can I get at the long reaches? And how do the pictures end up looking? And number one thing I noticed was, wow, the iPhone really sucks. And if you look at, like, I've thought for a while, wow, the iPhone is an amazing camera. And that is still true, but it's not an amazing camera when you want reach. The 3x lens on the iPhone 14 Pro that I was using for these comparisons sucks. And I've noticed, you know, the iPhone 14, the iPhone 14 Pro cameras, I have noticed so far this year of using this phone that the amount of over-processing and over-sharpening is kind of irritating to me a lot of the time. Not every time. I still get a lot of good photos with it, and it's still going to be the camera that I use by far the most because it's always in my pocket, but the amount of processing that it does is a little off-putting. And so I might try to experiment with apps like Halide, you know, to see maybe if I do more manual control, maybe I can get a better balance that I like more. But I am not super thrilled with the iPhone 14 Pro's camera system in the sense that I have tried to make it replace a big camera, and at first I thought it really could. And now I see it really can't. It does really well for what it is. But at the end of the day, it is still a tiny little sensor with tiny little optics that have to cost probably like $40 or $50. And so there's going to be a lot of limitations there for physics, for components, for quality. Like there's so much that's limiting it. And it makes up for a lot of that with its smarts and its, you know, various processing and intelligence and what it does with that sensor and how it dumps data off and how it deals with everything. There's a lot of intelligence there, and it really is incredible for what it is. But there's a lot more out there. And so what this experiment has taught me is there's still a place in my life for other cameras. So anyway, I took pictures of faraway objects with all these cameras, including the iPhone and the RX100. And the iPhone, I showed the regular 3X resolution, the regular 3X perspective, and I zoomed it all the way in with its digital zoom just so you could see what that looks like. It's not good. I would not recommend using the digital zoom for anything, but it's there so you can compare. And what I was, so first of all, I was very, very impressed with the little Sony RX100. If you look at the pictures it got, it blows away the iPhone for reach, and it's really not bad. It's not great, and I think I've decided for the moment not to buy one. And it also doesn't have USB-C because it's so old. But anyway, it's not an amazing optical quality, but for its size, it's fantastic. And I could very easily see at some point me justifying the plan of just keeping one on my backpack all the time, because it really is an incredibly versatile camera. It even has, my favorite part about the RX100 is it has this cute little pop-up viewfinder. You hit this little tab on its side, and this little tiny cube goes pop, and it pops up this little, it's the cutest little viewfinder, and it works. I use it outside because it's so bright. It works. Like, it was great. Anyway, it's an adorable camera. It is not something I want to ever put in a pocket. It is something I would occasionally carry in a jacket, and I would very much carry in a backpack if I had more frequent needs like that, because it really does cover a lot that the iPhone doesn't cover. And for what it is and for its size, I'm extremely impressed by the RX107. All right, moving on. In rough order of price, the Nikon Coolpix 1000, this is the one that can go to 3000 millimeter equivalent. This camera, it does that by using a much smaller sensor. You'll even notice its pictures are 4x3, not 3x2, the way most cameras are, because it's basically a phone sensor, as far as I can tell. Like, as far as the reviews kind of said that, I'm like, that's interesting. And then I noticed, like, it shoots natively in 4x3, so it's like, oh, maybe there's something to that. But anyway, the 3000 millimeter equivalent is kind of hilarious. It is also kind of like the iPhone digital zoom, not especially useful. Because the problem is, when you get to 3000 millimeters, when you're like, you know, in that kind of range, stabilization becomes extremely difficult. Like, I was standing on a deck, and even if I put it on a tripod, the vibrations of the deck from wind, from like a slight breeze, were making it jiggle visibly. And so even to get these pictures, I had to have the shutter speed way up, like 2,500th of a second, like way, way up, super fast shutter on, you know, right in the middle of the day, just so I could get some kind of, you know, sharpness in these pictures. Most of the pictures I shot at those far reaches were totally blurry and unusable. These that I got in my sample gallery were the best ones that I shot, and I did everything I could to make that happen. So I would say that when I shot it also at 600 millimeters, and just so we can kind of see, like, you know, how does that look compared to the other ones? And it's fine when you're zoomed out, like if you're not like looking too closely at the pixels. If you look too closely at the pixels, it's a mess, even at 600 millimeters, and it gets way worse at 3000. Like, when you zoom in, it's a mess. Like, it is not good. So the P1000, I think it's a fun novelty, but ultimately it's very hard to get good pictures out of it. Even when you do, it's just not a very sophisticated sensor in there. And I found the stabilization at 600 millimeters was not as good as the other cameras and lenses at that same length. So it's not a very good stabilizer. It's a very like plasticky, like kind of light, cheap kind of feeling camera. it's a fun novelty to rent, but I was not impressed by it, honestly.
And this looks big. This is not the bottom left, but the one directly to the right of it, correct?
Correct, yeah. Of course, I mean, it goes to... When you turn... So those cameras, that's in their off position. When you turn them on and when you zoom in, the lens sticks out like a Pringles can at the front. Like, it extends outward. It looks really hilarious. Like, it looks ridiculous. But it was, you know... Anyway, this is not their fully activated state. So anyway,
no. The reason I bring that up is only because it's not like you can shrug this off as, well, the pictures aren't the greatest, but the camera is tiny. Like, the camera is pretty big until you start comparing to the, you know, lenses. And so I this doesn't seem like it has very many redeeming qualities at all from what I'm hearing.
No, but I mean, but it is half the price of the next one, which is the Sony RX10, okay, which is the one in the bottom left corner. So Sony RX10, it is a, you know, almost double the price of the P1000. I will say the RX10-4 really impressed me for what it is, for how big it is, or rather isn't, for how heavy it isn't, and how easily it handled. I was very impressed with the RX10 Mark IV. It took pretty good pictures. It only goes to 600 millimeters, which is pretty great. The only reason I say, quote, only 600 millimeters is that relative to some of the other ones, that's not the furthest, but it's pretty great, and it achieves pretty good detail relative to its price and size and trade-offs. So I was pretty impressed by the RX10-4. And I think if I was in the market to buy an integrated super zoom camera, that's the one I would buy. It isn't worth trading in my giant full frame, you know, my giant gear for that, just because the bigger gear surprise is better. But it's not, you know, the bigger gear is like three times the total cost or two times the total cost, and probably three times the total size and weight. And I wouldn't say it's three times better. So anyway, that's the RX10-4, a very solid contender. There's a reason why that camera is so well rated, and so well liked. Next, I have my new Fuji X-T5, and I rented the Fuji 150-600mm giant telephoto lens with that. And as usual, it, I think, had the most pleasing colors. I would say the Fuji 150-600 is a substantially sharper and nicer lens than the Sony 200-600, even though it is not as optically fast. And what's interesting is that because the Fuji is made for its crop sensor cameras, it's made for APS-C size sensors, its 600 millimeters is an equivalent of 900 millimeters. So I shot all these, at, you know, and you can see, like, it is more zoomed in, and you get pretty sharp results. It is a little tricky to focus in certain lighting. Again, that's, I think, mostly due to Fuji's focus system, not the lens. But it is surprisingly good and surprisingly detailed, and the picture I have on the left of, like, the sign with the waves behind it, I think the Fuji nailed that one way better than everyone else. So that overall, very impressed by the Fuji. And then finally, I have my trusty old Sony A7R3 with its 200-600mm lens. I did two sets, one with the teleconverter to get it to 1200mm, and one without the teleconverter, and it did fantastically in terms of detail. Like the text on the sign on the right set, the text, I think, is the best on the Sony series. But the lens overall is just not a very sharp lens.
I was definitely looking at the text in the same thing. And I have to say, the Sony, the very bottom one, either with or without the teleconverter, has sharper text than any of the other ones. Like, so you say, oh, the lens isn't as sharp. Well, the text is sharp. Like, that's why I was looking for text, because we know what text can look like. In particular, if you look at ripcurrents.noaa.gov, mm-hmm, the descender in the G in .gov is right on top of a rivet.
Yeah.
That rivet reads, mm-hmm, way better on either one of the Sony pictures than it does on the Fuji one. Like, that's, if you pixel peep, yeah, that and go in that, like, it's just sharper. It's sharper. It's not as fuzzy. It's not, I can't even tell that it's a rivet in the other ones. I definitely, looking at all these pictures, I was surprised to see that even with the teleconverter, which usually hurts your, you know, sharpness and light gathering or whatever, that the Sony is comes out on top as far as I'm concerned. I mean, and it's close. Like, it's not like the Fuji with that giant lens is much worse than the Sony with the giant lens, but I would definitely say that the Sony is sharper. Now, I think if you had not that you need an excuse to spend more money, but like, you know, the A7R is up to the A7R 5 now, and that is not the most recent big giant ridiculously expensive white zoom lens from Sony. So if you know, refreshed all of that with modern Sony stuff to compete against your modern Fuji stuff, I think it would probably widen the gap even more.
It's possible. I mean, certainly, you know, it would have more resolution and everything, but yeah, I was surprised, you know, just owning the Sony lens, I've been surprised like how little I like the pictures that I ever get out of it. And I don't know maybe that's just...
And I have to say, I've heard this from other people as well. And so you're not, you know, this is you, but I either like what the Sonys do, or whatever difference you're seeing, I don't see or don't care about. Yeah. Like the way they call it, the color science or whatever. I see the differences from camera to camera, but like, I would never choose a camera based on it. Like, cause I always just feel like I can, you know, I guess it's because what it comes down to is, like you said, I'm editing these things. I mean, yeah. Any picture I care about, I'm editing. So, like, if there's something I dislike about, you know, the JPEG that came out, I'll go to the RAW and change it to the way I want it. I really don't care how the JPEGs look, especially when you're talking about one of these gigantic camera rigs where you're like, I'm done shooting in RAW, right? But if you've got that gigantic camera that's the, you know, longer than your arm and it weighs a ton and you're setting it all up or whatever, spend the 5 minutes to edit it. Like, you know, but I need the JPEGs to come out exactly how I want them, but I'm willing to lug around a camera that's smaller than that's bigger than my child to take the photo. Like, I don't quite understand that trade off. For the pocketable one, sure. But for the, you know, white colored camera lens that is gigantic and costs $1 billion, edit those photos.
I don't see it. Sometimes I find with the Sonys that, like, no matter what I do with the edit, I can't get the colors to look what I want them to look
but,
like.
I do wonder what you're looking for. Like, I think the Sonys look okay. Like, I don't know, you know, maybe it's a little bit like the Fujis I've always felt look a little bit. It's kind of like when people, you know, like the Sonys always to me look mostly neutral, whereas the Fujis remind me more of film, just setting aside the ones where it's trying to look like film, like you were talking about. And I don't want the film look, whether intentionally trying to look like film or just kind of like accidentally looking like film. I want it to be, I wouldn't call the Sony more neutral, but that's how I think of it, is like the Sony is just showing me the colors that were there without trying to massage them, which I know isn't true. The Sony has its own bent about how it handles reds and stuff like that. Like, I can see that, but I definitely wouldn't choose a camera based on it. It's strange to hear that it is such a factor in your decision-making about which cameras you want, even when we're talking about giant zoom lens on a giant big camera.
Well, and I think it's more that, like, if I'm going to get out my big camera and actually use it over my iPhone, it isn't about, you know, I feel like I've lived in Sony land for a while now. Like, we used to be a Canon family. Tiff still has her old Canon gear because she never ended up liking the Sony pictures very much. She has the same complaints I have of, like, just can't get them to look the way you want. And where Sony excels in extreme technical skill at the expense of being really boring, which actually is kind of my greatest strengths and weaknesses as well as a person. But, but, like, you know, Sony, there's not a lot of you know, pizzazz or excitement in the way Sony renders things. It doesn't make you go, wow, but it's technically very much, very, very high. And it beats everyone else on technical specs most of the time. And so there are lots of situations where that's okay, or that's what you want. Like, if you're going to be heavily editing the pictures afterwards, that makes a lot of sense. But I know myself well enough to know that I'm not going to edit. Like, a long time ago, I at some point for a Christmas one year, my gift to Tiff was we rented this crazy high-priced Leica camera, also from Lens Rentals. We've done a lot of stuff with them over the years. It was this whatever Leica was their digital rangefinder at the time. I think I even made a blog post about it. And my impression of it when we had it was, first of all, being a rangefinder was such a giant pain in the butt to use. If you've never used a rangefinder, consider yourself lucky. If you have, I'm sorry, you probably hate me right now. But such a massive pain in the butt to shoot things with a rangefinder. And at the end of the day, I was disappointed by the camera's you know, high ISO performance. You know, it sucked in low light. It didn't, you know, being a rangefinder, it didn't have autofocus at all. And it was the technical side of it, I was very disappointed by. But over the following years, I would always look back on those photos and be like, man, I love these pictures. I love the way they look. And it's not because of its technical perfection, because it didn't have that. It wasn't because it did great in low light, because it didn't. It wasn't because it had the highest resolution, because it didn't. I just liked the way they rendered colors between Leica's optics and whatever they were doing in the camera to process those colors. I just liked the pictures a lot better than than the other ones I was getting at the time. And it's, you know, it's indescribable, but you know, you like what you like, right? And so anyway, that we didn't go the Leica direction for many reasons. Although honestly, I considered renting a Q2 during this run, but it would have like doubled the price of my entire rental. I'm like, it's fine, I don't want to do that. But anyway, I thought, you know, for a while we left Canon land, or I did at least, to go to Sony World, because Sony World had just the amazing technical chops. So good in low light. The Sony full frame sensors back like with the first, you know, the first Sony A series cameras were just kicking Canon's butt. They were so much better back in that time. And so that got me over to Sony land. But ultimately, while I've taken a lot of decent pictures with the Sony, I'm not loving the pictures I get out of my Sony cameras as much as I used to love some of the Canon stuff I was getting, as much as I love those rented Leica pictures, and as much as I love the handful of pictures I've shot so far with the Fuji gear. It just doesn't fit me, and I've tried, I've edited them, and I've tried processing them and doing different things, and I just can't get out of the Sony what I want in terms of, you know, niceness, something I love. It's you not know, about technical
I'm not sure this is a good analogy, but when I listen to you say this, it makes me think of the somewhat similar situation in the audio world of people who we've talked about in the past, people who like the smile curve because it makes movies exciting, where you boost the bass and you boost the treble and you dip the mids, and people who want a more neutral sound. And then there are people who think a neutral sound is super boring. And it sounds to me like you like the Leica smile curve, and neutral photos seem like poison to you, and that also that you're unable to reproduce the smile curve when you try to manually edit it. And I would have to think the inability to reproduce the thing you want from a neutral photo mostly comes down to not knowing what it is that you need to do with your neutral photo to make it look like those Leica photos, right? Because it's an indescribable thing that, you know you like it, you see it, you know you like it. But if you don't know, all right, how do I go from neutral to that? You're never going to be able to do it just by, you know, randomly poking at curves and stuff to try to make it happen.
Yeah, and part of that is because it's really complicated, and you know, it's like when you try to correct something.
Yeah,
like
it's not as simple as just push this dial up on the equalizer and you're done, right?
Right. Yeah, it's like trying to correct something you don't like about headphones with EQ. It's like you can sometimes do that a little bit, but it's usually the whole frequency response and distortion characteristics and reflection characteristics of a headphone are so much more complicated than just, you know, the basic EQ controls you have, and that's how I feel with photos. Like I can use something like Lightroom or the built-in Photos app and, you know, use the editing controls. I've done that before. I did that for years. And sometimes it would work out for me. Usually not. And it's partly because it's more complicated than that. It's also largely because I'm not very good at it, and I'm never going to be very good at it.
And so, you have to start from RAW to have a fighting chance. Because if you start from the JPEG, you're just, you know, you're screwed.
Exactly. And so, anyway, so I've decided that my camera journey is, I'm gonna abandon technical class leadership, I think, and just go with what I love. Go with what gives me the pictures I love. And right now, that is Fuji. And I never tried Fuji before because they weren't leading in the technical stuff. They never had like the best, you know, high ISO noise performance. They usually didn't have the best, you know, megapixel resolution. I didn't really know anything about their lens situation. They didn't have anything full frame. It's funny. They don't have full frame. They have APS-C, and they went right to medium format. And they have nothing in between. But anyway, you know, I thought for a long time that what I wanted was technical perfection. But I now know what I want is pictures I love. And Some of those are going to come from iPhones. Some of those are going to come from Fujis. Some of those are going to come from random rented Sonys here and there. But I'm getting a lot more of them from Fujis, and my hit rate is quite good.
I will give your Sony gear a good home.
I will probably be sending some of it to you. First, I'm gonna trade some of it to Beck, probably to B&H, to get probably to buy this Fuji lens, and then we'll talk. All right. Do you want to end here, Casey, and then we can have time for the good after show?
It's whatever you want. I think that's fine. I'm trying to balance what is the best to offset for those who don't like the camera talk. I was enjoying it, but for those who don't like the camera talk, what's the best offset? And I don't think I have a strong feeling one way or the other.
Yeah, I think we can end here because I want to leave enough time for the after show. The after show is good.
Your after show is going to take some time. Whether people like it or not, there's always another episode next week.
Yeah, exactly. <Fair enough. laughs> The best thing about our show, there's always going to be more of it. All right. Thanks to our sponsors this week, Green Chef, Trade Coffee, and Squarespace. And thanks to our members. Once again, big, big thank you for the members. We've had wonderful membership numbers recently, and we've got tons of great feedback on our member-exclusive episodes we've done recently. Lots of great feedback on the Totoro episode. Lots of great feedback on the food one before that. Like, we're on a roll here. So thank you so much to members. You can join at atb.fm/join. We'll talk to you next week.
So I'm going to do my dear friend Mike dirty and talk about something that we spoke about a little bit on Analog this week, but isn't out yet. This is the pain that comes from analog recording on a Tuesday, but not typically being released until Sunday. So I'm sort of taking away Mike's exclusive. And I'm sorry, Mike. I'm sorry. It wasn't my intention.
Hey, we were here first. We are.
Well, he was there first. It's just nobody heard it but the two of us. So
Marco's and the rapid production cycle wins again.
You got a ship. Real artist ship, you know?
Oh, brutal. Poor Mike. I'm sorry, Mike. So what we talked about, Mike and myself, and I will put a link to the as we record this forthcoming episode of Analog, but will soon, by Sunday, will be the released episode of Analog. Mike and I talked about my forthcoming app. And
woo.
I am pretty sure this one's actually going to see the light of day. It is not ready yet. It is getting pretty close. But I thought I would try something different and talk about it a bit. And I'm not really sure why I wanted to try something different other than it's different. But I figured we could talk about it, the three of us and the listeners kind of by proxy and see what we think. So what am I up to? As usual, I don't have a good name. If you recall, in the past, I didn't come up with, I think it was my friend Steve that came up with Masquerade, if memory serves, but that didn't happen until pretty late in the development cycle. I don't have a good name for it, and I have an even worse icon for it for those who are on the test flight, which is basically just friends at this point.
Do you want to share the terrible name? Just so you can explain to me how you came up with this terrible name.
Okay, so the
figured it out. Go ahead, see if I'm right.
So the code name is I don't want to pronounce it because joke. No. So the code name is the word lookup with an F in front of it, which is supposed to be a portmanteau of film lookup to become flookup. Right. Well, I said this to Aaron, or I showed Aaron the name. I did not verbalize it to her, and she says, "Flookup." What the hell is flookup?
It does look up. Like fluke up. Now that I see, like I instantly read in my head fluke up when I saw it. But I
read fluke up, and then I tried F look up, and I was like, no, they're both bad.
Well, they're both bad. I mean, full stop. They're both bad.
Fluke up.
So it's
look up.
It's awful. It's no feed on this one, not yet. Anyway, so I need a name. I'm still working on that, and I need an icon. The icon is fluke up.
I think it's a funny name.
No, do not listen to Marco. It's a terrible name.
With respect,
I always
Marco,
like your initial terrible names.
Well, it's probably better than Face Splash. That's neither here nor there.
But only marginally.
Oh, God.
But anyway, in any case, so we're getting off track already. So what the heck is it? The thesis statement, if you will, is imagine IMDb, but written by someone who has self-respect. And so what this is born from is I often, when I'm watching a television show or a movie or some such, I would want to know, who is this person, or where do I know this person from, or what have you. And for years and years and years and years, I would use the IMDb app or the website. The website is still mostly okay.
Disagree.
It's not great.
So bad.
It's unusable.
Hate it so much. I hate it.
Well, I can use the website and I can do it without actively vomiting on myself.
Without scrolling up and down the page 7 times. And that, well,
fair.
It's got to be here, right?
That is fair. That is totally fair. That is totally fair.
That is the experience by IMDb. I hate it so much.
However, I will say that the IMDb app, in my personal opinion, is unusable and has been for like 2 or 3 years now. So the reasons I don't like the IMDb app, not to belabor it, it's constantly like playing videos or trying to play videos or show you images at like 3/4 the size of the screen. I don't want to log in. I don't want to log in. Stop asking. I don't fucking want to log in. Just stop. So that in and of itself is enough to drive me nuts. And it's very gross now. It's clear that Amazon owns it. It's clear they want you to either watch their shows or buy things from them. And it's just frustrating. And so I started wondering, well, could I fix this problem? And there's a pretty great website called The Movie Database. And we'll put a link to The Movie Database in the show notes. It is a kind of I don't want to say knockoff, that's kind of disrespectful, but it's an alternative to IMDb. I'll be the first to tell you the data is not quite as good as IMDb's, but it's pretty close. And for any of the major stuff, it'll be there. And so I started digging and looking, and well, wow, they have an API, and wow, this API seems to make sense. It's not completely bananas. And if all you're doing is reading stuff, you don't need to log into anything. And so that's how FlickUp was born, or whatever I end up calling it. And the idea is, what if it's IMDb by someone who actually cares? And it lets you look up TV, movies, episodes of TV shows, you know, seasons of TV shows, and people as well. And I started the first commit. I should have this handy. I'm sorry, but the first commit on this was something like January 25th or thereabouts. And I think I am in a position that, barring the name and icon, I could send this to App Review in the next few days, I think. So I am pretty darn proud of how fast it's come together. It's 100% Swift UI. I'm literally not using UIKit for anything as far as I can recall. It's using Async Await, which has gone really, really well. And I'm just really enjoying writing it. And I'm having a lot of fun with it, which is cool. The most interesting thing at the moment is, how do you monetize it? But actually, I should interrupt and say, do you two have anything you want to talk about, add, or ask before I start talking about monetization?
Yeah, first of all, you know, I will nitpick. You know, when you sent me the very first version, I nitpicked a few things. I did my trademark video tour. I've been holding back until things calm down a little bit to send my final design nitpicks. But this is coming together really well. I think this might be your best app yet. I mean, it's really good. Like, and it's very useful. And this, I think this is going to be useful to a lot of people. This could be it. And I'm happy to hear that you've, you know, quote, only worked on it for, you know, about 3 or 4 months now, because that's how to become a successful iOS developer is like, try stuff. You know, you got to put stuff out there. You got to try it and see like what's going to work and you know, what's going to stick, what's going to find an audience, what's not. That's what you got to do. And, you know, if you're spending like a whole, you know, year on an app and you put it out there and it's actually a pretty specialized thing that doesn't have a huge audience, that's not a great use of your time. And if you want this to become a bigger part of what you do, this is how to do that. You know, you get an app like this where it's like you identified a pretty substantially sized market. It's a big market. You built something that doesn't seem to have major costs to you. Like, you're not running the servers. You're not running any kind of back end service for this. You know, you're not paying for the API, it seems, right?
So there's a whole story there. We'll get back to that. But suffice to say, right, so far that is correct.
Right. So there's that. And you made something that looks and feels pretty good without taking a ton of time to do it. That's a great story. And the result is really good. Like, it's very useful. It is something that, you know, I've used a couple of times so far. The only reason I haven't used it more is that I don't watch a lot of movies. But when I do, I have the same need. And when, you know, I'll do the same thing during TV shows. Like, oh, it's that guy. What's he from again? You know, and I'll, you know, go look it up. or whatever. And I think this is great. I really do. I think this shows this shows your growth as an independent iOS developer. Like you are getting better, and your ideas are getting more mainstream. And this is, I think, a pretty good opportunity. And you know, I will nitpick things, you know, obviously. But
that's why you're here. That's why you're here.
But I have less to nitpick here than any of your previous apps when I first seen them.
Yeah, and like, it's come less. A long way. It's come a long way, and I think some of that is me. Some of that is our mutual friend Ben McCarthy, who makes Obscura, among other things. I'll put a link to Obscura in the show notes. It's a like an alternative camera app. Ben had some really phenomenal UI ideas that they shared with me, and that I think made a tremendous difference. Anything that looks good, it's either him or me. Anything that looks bad, I have to reboot them. That. Hi, future Marco. Anything looks good is either them or me, and anything looks bad is 100% me. So that's what we can agree.
Wait, I'm
on.
Taking credit for my, you know, PG-13R, like the styling.
Oh, that's
of the
true.
Rating.
That's true.
Me.
I'm sorry. No, you're right. I completely forgot about that. You're 100% correct. But no,
I'm the one who first ripped off the MPAA for you.
No, I do feel like it looks pretty good. It's not perfect by any means, but it looks pretty good. I'm pretty happy with it. John, any commentary before we talk monetization and API stuff?
I was going to say, when I was thinking of this app, like, I immediately understood what you were making, even when the app did nothing, it was terrible, like, the first release, right? But I understood, like, it was clear to me. And to be clear, you sent this app to us, and, like, you didn't explain anything about it. And I saw the icon, and I didn't understand what the heck it was, and it was terrible. But then I launched it, I'm like, oh, I get it. IMDb, but not sucking. All right, so thumbs up on the concept. I have to say, for me personally, and this does not affect your market, because your market is much more mass market, but for me personally, your biggest competition, which is currently way, way ahead of you because they've been out for years and years and years, is Letterboxd, right? And I know they don't do TV, and I know it's not really the point of that site, but they have had so many years to polish their experience of finding movies and who's in them and what other things they might be in and stuff like that. And their site and their app, which is just really just their website, is not junked up like IMDb. So I feel like within the realm of people who even know what the heck Letterboxd is, it is very strong competition because it is not, I mean, I think it's way better than the movie database site. It's certainly better than IMDb. It is the same ethos as you is, hey, guess what? A thing that people might want to use to find information that is nicely organized and laid out. And this site was not created in the last 3 months, right? So they have a big lead on you. Your advantage is nobody who's not a giant film nerd knows about Letterboxd, and honestly, it's overkill for the simple use cases of I'm on the couch, want to find out what this person's in. I go to it because I use Letterboxd all the time, and I do movie stuff or whatever, but Marco is not the target audience for Letterboxd, and he would use your app. So, and this is also to say, if you want some good ideas about how to lay things out and how to do UI and stuff like that, go to Letterboxd at their website. And again, their quote-unquote app, I think, is just a web view onto their mobile version of their site, which is a testament to how good the mobile version of their site is. But I would say check that out for some good ideas.
No, I should do that. Yeah, it's funny because a lot of the people that I've sent the beta to seem to, the cross section between my friends and Letterboxd users seems to be quite strong. I am not a Letterboxd user. It's not something I think I need or want in my life, but I can totally understand why one would want it. Like, I use Goodreads fairly religiously to track the things that I've read, and it's a very similar idea.
I congratulate you for your ability to pronounce the name of that site differently than me in the same conversation and not giving in like the gif people do when you're conversing about somebody with it and you can't help but just start copying the other person's pronunciation, like whoever said it first. But no, you're holding strong. And to be clear, Casey is pronouncing it the right way and I'm pronouncing it the John way.
we'll see how well I do, but in any case, so I think if this continues to be a thing and if it's not just a flop, then one thing that I've gotten some very clear interest in, at least because of the small test group I've sent it to, is having Letterboxd integration and, you know, marking, or I guess I don't even know what that would mean, to be honest, because again, I don't really use Letterboxd, but I would investigate that and see what makes sense to be in both places. But that's, you know, that's another version way down the road. So with regard to monetization, so Marco touched on this earlier. It's a little bit of a squishy thing because the movie database seems to not want my money. So they have like a couple of different, and this is just for the listeners, not even just the members, but for the listeners, because this is kind of putting me in a little bit of an awkward spot. So I could belabor this story quite a bit, but suffice to say, I've asked several times to get a commercial key, like, you know, API key from the movie database. I've asked in this one place over here and another place over there. And so far, they refuse to give one to me. They keep ghosting me when I ask them. And I'm like, hey, you know, I'm currently using a developer key. That's fine. But this will be sold at some point. Can I have a commercial key? Crickets. So I've back-channeled a little bit with some people that are using the movie database API in other uses. And I don't think they're ever going to want my money. That's not like it's in writing or anything, right? So like, I need to account for the fact that this is an API that I don't own and I don't control. And it is perfectly within their, you know, rights to say, you got to pony up, big guy. So since this is something that hopefully people would use a lot and hopefully a lot of people would use, I need to have some sort of recurring revenue. I don't want to be put in a situation where suddenly my weather API, so to speak, not in a literal sense, you know, the weather app, the weather API that goes from free to not free to, oh my gosh, expensive. So I think what I'm going to do is make this a subscription app. And I did not start down that path, but I think it was Underscore in a conversation we were having said to me, look, you got to go subscription because you never know what the future will bring. I hope I'm not putting words in Underscore's mouth. I'm pretty sure it was him that started this in my head, but that makes me think, okay, I should do a subscription. But that in turn, I don't think it's the right use to begs the question, but begs the question.
Raises the question.
There it is. Thank you. How much does one charge for this? And honestly, I don't have a great answer because, you know, I was looking at, you know, what can I think of as something that has a clear and obvious cost, recurring cost to the company, and even an end user would understand that. And how much does that cost? Well, there's an app called Overcast that has a clear and recurring cost to the person or persons that run Overcast, and I should look at how much that is. And
no, you shouldn't.
If I'm not mistaken, Overcast is $10 a year. So to me, that sets a high threshold that I don't think I should be even that particularly close to $10 a year. But then where should I be? And honestly,
sure.
I don't know.
See, I get what you're saying. It was like, oh, I have a comparable, as they say in the real estate industry, but it's yeah, not yeah. comparable. Setting aside whether Marco's pricing is right.
It's
which,
not.
Right. But like, here's the deal. Like, no one who is interested in buying your app knows or cares what Overcast goes for. Yeah, they're not competitors. They might not even know Overcast exists, right? It's the question is not that this makes it easier, but I'm just saying the question is, how much are people willing to pay for an app that does what your app does?
When right? there's a very,
and that
very
has almost no connection to how much are they willing to pay for a podcast app that does what Overcast does.
Sure.
And then the second question is, oh, is Overcast charging the right amount?
So, and I'm assuming, Marco, you think you should be charging more?
Yeah, definitely.
I agree.
When I, you know, when I launched Overcast Premium, God knows how many years ago, subscriptions for, you know, non-content apps, like, you know, it was subscriptions for, like, you know, newsstand apps were common, you know, stuff like that. But like subscriptions for like regular app functionality, that was not that common still back then. And $10 a year felt like a bit of a reach, but like a doable reach. So I did it. Now, I mean, look, I just told you, you know, 5 hours ago when we began this episode, I just told you that there was this app that made the EDR photos for me. It's a like one feature app that I'm going to use here and there occasionally. It's $3 a month or $30 lifetime. And I jump right for the $30 lifetime purchase. But if I didn't, it was $3 a month. Like that, and I'm charging $10 a year for an app that people use typically, you know, multiple hours a day. You know, the comparison, as John said, is not, you know, super direct between what many different apps do. But if I was launching today, I would not charge $10 a year. I would probably, I mean, look, even my competitors, like if you look at other podcast apps that charge money for anything at all, I mean, Spotify, you got to pay, what is it, $10 a month to have mm-hmm. Spotify podcasts or whatever. And, you know, Apple is, you know, free with the cost of their hardware, but then, you know, separately other stuff. But then also, like, you know, if I want to have, you know, if you look at other, you know, Castro, Pocket Cast, like other podcast apps, I'm cheaper than all of them for like the premium feature set. I think all of us are like free up front now, but the premium feature set, I'm by far the cheapest, I think. By half or more. And so, if I were doing this today, I would probably go to 20 a year, maybe. Or maybe I'd have some kind of monthly. I don't know. Maybe I'd have to do like a free trial, which I still have not done. You know, I don't know necessarily what I would do, but it wouldn't be $10 a year. It would be substantially more in some way. That being said, Overcast is not $10 a year. Overcast is free with ads or $10 a year.
Mm-hmm.
And you can put ads in this, and that's what most people would do. And it would be, you know, you would crap up the experience and be exactly what you are trying to not do.
Exactly.
But, you know, you would make some money from ads. Like, that's the thing. And you could have, you know, most people would leave them, and you'd make, you know, a few pennies here and there from those people. And then people like me who are, you know, jerks about ads, you know, not wanting to see ads in my apps if I don't have to, we would pay for whatever the unlock would be. And that would be it. And you know, you'd get some purchases for the no ads purchase, and you get some purchases for the ads, or some money from the ads, and that would be it. That is probably the best way to do it. Whether you'd want to do that or not, it's a different story. But that, like, if you want to maximize your money, that's what you should do, is put ads in it and, you know, and tolerate some crappiness. But again, that's not the way to make the best app necessarily. That's the way to make the most money. Go ahead.
So to complete the trifecta of not taking any pricing advice from your podcast co-hosts, the tiny number of people who use my two apps run them 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So I should be charging tons of money. Instead, it's a one-time price that never repeats. don't price like my apps, and apparently don't price like Margo's apps.
Now,
I guess he's saying yes, price like his app, but don't price just like the premium portion of his app. Don't forget there's the free part with ads.
Yeah, and by the way, you know, what you said a minute ago about you don't know what the future holds in terms of your API access to the service that your app depends on and is useless without, to me, that's a giant red flag for a subscription purchase. Because, you know, what just happened with the Twitter apps, you know, like that were cut off and had to refund, you know.
And I would say, even if that API is free forever, even if, you know, they never charge you any money for it. And I would say that any app, and setting aside what Marco was just saying, is that, look, every app charges subscriptions no matter what they do now. But any app that accesses a third-party API that you don't control should charge a subscription. Not that it'd be expensive subscription, but it should charge a subscription. It could be $1 a year, but whatever it is. Because that app is guaranteed to require some kind of ongoing maintenance above and beyond the just keeping up with the latest version of iOS, because APIs change, unless they're dead. I mean, if the API is dead, then you have separate problems, right? Because APIs change, and that means you'll have to update your app, or you'll want to update your app. Like, there's, you know, you are essentially writing on top of a thing that you don't control. We're all writing on top of the Apple platform, and we have to keep up with those changes. We have no choice. But I think once you go the extra step of saying, oh, and by the way, my app is essentially a front end for an API that has nothing to do with me, you will have to, you know, ride that bear in the Steve Ballmer sense. You will have to continue to chase that API. Wherever that API goes, you don't have control over it. And wherever it goes, you have to follow it, or your app doesn't work or breaks or is worse. And so that argues for, unless you're just going to give up on the app after a year or something, that argues for some tiny little subscription fee or a one-time purchase that's enough to fund your ongoing maintenance and development for what you think the life of the app is going to be.
Yeah, and that's what makes it tough, is if I knew for sure that it was free forever, I would probably just charge, like I always do, like a one-time fee and call it a day. But even leaving aside, or even considering the Twitter debacle from a month or two back, I still feel like it makes sense to account for the possibility of, oh, this they've decided to charge me. That money's got to come from somewhere. Otherwise, I am utterly doomed. And so it seems to me like a subscription is the right answer. Now, I echo what you're saying, Marco, that if I was really going for a money grab, without question, advertisements and then, you know, an unlock, or, you know, remove ads, unlock or whatever, that would make way more sense and surely be way more lucrative. But I just don't want to do that, I don't think.
And fair. That's a totally valid answer.
And the advantage of having ATP and analog and the apps that I have is that in terms of finances, I don't need to do that, or at least not today. Ask me again in a week. But sitting here now, I don't need to do that. Like I don't need this thing to go gangbusters in order to put a food on the table. And so I'd rather do something that I'm this is going to sound a little flippant and I'm sorry, but I'd rather do something I'm extremely proud of than junk the app up with ads that I don't control. I think Overcast is a bit of a weird exception because that's your own ads and that's a very different beast. But that's
and
not
also
something
the
I
major
could do.
Selling proposition of your app is it's like that other thing you're familiar with, but not junked up, and ads are part of that, right?
Yeah,
and so
exactly.
If you'd have to have like an asterisk, like unless you have the free
less
version, which
junk.
Most people have. Yeah.
Right. There's fewer pieces.
It's
of junk,
it's like when Twitter tried
junk.
to Twitter Blue. They said pay for Twitter Blue and you'll get fewer ads.
Yeah. Right.
Not no ads, just fewer ads.
It's like
what does that mean?
New York Times subscription.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I pay to have the worst reading experience in their app. Anyway,
hooray. Yeah,
no, but you know, keep in mind though, this is a double-edged sword. People's alternative is to just go to IMDb or whatever and get this information for free covered in ads. So if you are offering something covered in ads too, you know, that's gonna hurt you a little bit. But also, if you're putting up a paywall too soon, that's also gonna hurt you a lot because people are gonna try this app like, oh, this is kind of nice. It's like IMDb but nice. Then they're gonna slam into a paywall. And most of them are going to be like, all right, bye. And like, so
exactly
it is going to, like, if your paywall is too, you know, too aggressive, people are going to bounce right out. And then word of mouth isn't going to happen. Ranking isn't going to happen. And no one's going to use it. If you have the paywall be, you know, too generous and give too much away for free, you'll make no money because nobody will go past the paywall. So it's a hard thing to do. Look, developers have debates and arguments and you know, anguish about this all the time because this is a very hard problem to solve. And I mean, look, it took me a long time to get it right in Overcast. It took me like 3 or 4 years before I came up with the system I have now that fortunately does work for me, but it took a while to get there. It took a lot of attempts, a lot of different systems to do it. So, you know, I can't necessarily say anything's going to work. I think ads, the ad-based business model with the option to pay to remove them is the cleanest conceptually. And it is the best in terms of maximizing the number of people you will get to install the app, the number of people who keep it installed and who will keep using it, and the number of people who and the amount of money you make. Like all of that will be maximized if you have ads and an option to remove the ads for some, you know, X per year or X one time or whatever. That will make you the most money and get you the most users. But if that's not the app you want to make, then don't do it. That's not, you know, no one's forcing you to do this. So you should make the app that you want to make. And so I totally get that. So the question is then, what do you do?
Right.
I would say, subscription does concern me from the point of view of the API thing. Like, you know, that's part of why the ad option makes that really clean. As long as the app works, you are seeing ads and we are making money. As soon as the app stops working, you'll stop using it and everything stops. And that's clean, you know? Anything you do involving taking people's money is going to be less clean than that and could bite you in the butt if things go badly down the road
I wouldn't worry about that, especially if you stick to monthly and don't even do an annual or something, but like whatever, like, you know, the whole thing where Apple's going to refund everybody for the Twitter apps because they shut it down or whatever, that's an extreme scenario. And I feel like the odds of that happening again are low. And if they happen, yeah, you just eat that. And if you're not expecting this to be like your main source of income that's going to bankrupt you if that happens, then you would just be like, oh, that'll be a bummer if it happens. But honestly, the odds of it are so low. Like, is the movie database run by a giant jerk? Like, probably not, or at least not an Elon Musk caliber jerk. So I wouldn't spend too much time fretting about that. I mean, so many apps on the App Store have subscriptions, and many of them have a thing that if it was run by a jerk like Elon who cut the thing off with nobody noticed, they'd be in the same situation. It just doesn't happen that often. That's why it was so shocking when he did it, that it is not a common thing, and I don't expect it to be a common thing. So I wouldn't lose too much sleep over that.
Well, and furthermore, I think the difference is that even if that were to happen, it is unlikely, not impossible, but unlikely it would be flick of a switch like it basically was for the Twitter apps.
They'd phase it out and you could sunset the app and it would, you know, whatever.
Yeah. So the other thing to consider is, you know, when we you know, fancy iOS people, you know, when we, like, you know, Apple enthusiasts and podcasters in this space, like, when we think about value of an app, we are thinking of it from our perspective, from what we think is valuable, from what we think is a reasonable price, and from the quality level that we set for ourselves as kind of a community. If you look at the App Store, it's not that. It's very far from that. If you look at pretty much everything else in the App Store, it's a ton of garbage with massive quantities of ads, huge, you know, tricky upsell things that try to shove you into a subscription deceptively, and then every app wants, like, $2 a week from you. Like, oh, you want to be able to crop photos? $5 a week. And no one bats an eye. Like, oh, well, hey, good for them. You know, I guess they can get the money. And then those are the ones that afford to buy all the search ads and everything. And, you know, it's a you know, self-fulfilling system. So, you know, that's the App Store. That's the market you're in. Most people's phones are filled with garbage apps to crop photos and stuff that are, you know, these thinly veiled subscription scams that are full of ads and are charging them $6 a week and just, like, extracting as much as possible from people. Like, that's most of the App Store. So, first of all, it doesn't take much to be better than that. Second of all, that's the price expectation or ad expectation that people have of apps, because that's what most apps are. Most apps are not the boutique apps from people who we know on you know, formerly Twitter and now Mastodon. That's not most apps. Most apps that most people are using are big corporate apps like Facebook stuff that are just their own form of specially abusive garbage. And then the huge long tail of all the garbage photo cropping apps that, you know, are full of these, you know, massive weekly subscriptions and stuff like that. So that's the market you're playing into here. So it's tricky. It can be tricky to figure out what's right for you. I think if you really don't want to do ads, which it sounds like you don't, and that's fine again, if you really don't want to do ads, then do a subscription. But keep in mind with the pricing of it that a lot of people are going to bounce right off. I mean, there is kind of an argument to be made for a one-time purchase, because I think people are so, like, burned by subscriptions recently. I think a one-time purchase is seen as refreshing to a lot of people. And since you don't have ongoing server costs for this now, and you
yet.
Probably...
yet.
Well, and then maybe you could change your mind down the road. But, like, since you don't have ongoing costs now, there is something to be said for that. But I think ultimately I would probably agree with the underscore, like, you know, you should probably have recurring revenue. But that will turn more people off at the door. So you kind of have to price it accordingly. And you can, with App Store subscriptions, they recently did add the option, which I think I might at some point use, that you can raise the price of a subscription without losing all your old subscribers. You couldn't do that before. You couldn't do that before about, I think, a year or two ago. They added it for Disney Plus, and they made it available for everybody. Or was it HBO? One of those. Anyway, one thing you could do, like, you know, because my worry with subscriptions would have been, like, you know, if you're charging people, you know, a buck or two a month, and then you all of a sudden have to pay for your API access, and it's more than that, that could be a problem for you.
Right.
But you don't have to worry about that. So what I would say is start people on a subscription plan, but make it a really cheap one. And then if you have to raise prices down the road because some API cost happens, so be it. If not, or until then, you will just keep making lots of sales that you wouldn't have made otherwise if it was too expensive. So I would say if I was doing this, and one other consideration, if you want to minimize your, like, refund liability down the road if things go really bad, monthly would be better than annual. But that being said, if you want it to seem really cheap, annual's the way to go. So,
right. Yep, exactly. And that's what I'm struggling against is I know that anyone who is likely to already have had an interest in the sorts of thing that FlickUp or whatever I end up calling it does, it probably already has the IMDb app installed on their phone. So I have to overcome free and already working. And that's tough. So my current thought, which I have no idea if it's wise or not, is $6 a year, because it's like it's like 50 cents a month. That's not that much. And it doesn't seem too aggressive. Like, you know, even a dollar or two a month seems like kind of a lot to me. And so $6 a year, it's more than nothing, but it's like, it's a coffee at Starbucks or something like that. You know, it's eight. What makes you say that?
$7.99 is a nice looking price. It still is under 10 bucks. People think it's cheap. But it doesn't seem that much more expensive than $5.99, and you'll get more money, and I think it's the same perceived price class.
I think the also you're talking about, like, well, the one time cost, people are tired of subscriptions, so on and so forth. It depends on how you're looking at the app, because if you start with a subscription, even if you price it like high, that it scares a lot of people away. If the app has any kind of success at all and you decide, yes, this is worth me working on, you can make the app grow into your price. Whereas if you started the app with a fixed price, you will grow out of your price. Like if the app turns out to be popular, then you will make the app better and better. And soon the app is good enough that you shouldn't be charging a one-time price of $5 or something. And it's so much harder, I feel like, to go from a one-time price of $5 to say, hey, everybody who bought this app that's actually getting some traction and becoming popular, guess what? It's a subscription now. Whereas if you started out at that subscription that was kind of expensive and the app grows into it, the original customers are satisfied because they're like, I bought it when it was a 1.0 and now it's so much better and I'm paying the same subscription. And then when you grow into the price, people look at the price and aren't as scared away because it's a better app now. Like, it just seems like, I feel like I've seen that happen too often where someone underprices it initially because the app's not that good, and everyone's app's not that good in the first release, right? But you have to think about, if this app works, if it works in the market at all, what will the app be like? And I always feel like it's better to price it like that, because that produces the least amount of regret among your customers, right? Because the people who are willing to buy it early when it was a 1.0 and it seemed kind of expensive, they'll be happy when your app improves and grows into it. And the people who weren't, they'll only arrive after your app goes into its price. But in both of those scenarios, everyone more or less is satisfied with and understands the deal. Whereas I hate seeing apps that's like, oh, it's just a 1.0 and it's not that good, so it's a $3 one-time purchase. And then like 2 years into development, the app is amazing and the developer's not making any money because, you know, the development costs and the maintenance overhead is high, but they feel like they can't increase the price, let alone go to subscription. Because you know what happens when you go from a fixed price to subscription, everyone hates it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the other thing I'm you know, looking at is, I don't ever want to have to renege and go into subscription. It's another thing if I choose to, I'm making this up, but if I choose to do like a forever unlock for, you know, $100 or something like that, again, I'm making this up, that I feel like that's different. But to go from a one-time only IAP to, oh, just kidding, I'll need your money periodically now, that's just really, really hard. That's just really hard to sell.
Buy my apps for the forever unlock price of $5.
Oh, God. I'm still regretting. Like, I sold for, I think, 1 year, Overcast's first year in 2014. Mm-hmm. I sold a $5 unlock. And
how did I not buy that? Is it because I was on the beta?
Probably. Or maybe you might have bought it. But I have a special case in the app. So if you have that $5 unlock, you don't get the premium feature of the uploads. Because that's, you know, monthly S3 costs that I have to pay. That wasn't there back then. Like, that came later. But you do have no ads shown if you have that original unlock, because there were no ads in the original app. And I have thought for a long time, like, I actually track in my analytics, like, how many of those people are still using the app? And it's a lot of people. Like, it's a substantial portion of my user base. And I've thought for a while, like, I should really end that ad exclusion from them, because these people paid $5 9 years ago, and I'm now, like, literally just, you know, 4 days ago, 5 days ago, my web host just raised prices 20% for no reason. So it's like, now my cost just went up by 20%. Awesome. Like, and I've been paying all these server costs for nine years.
And yet those people will be,
people.
They'll be so mad when it happens too, because if you explain to them, you paid $5 9 years ago, and they'll say, and kind of rightly, yeah, but 9 years ago you said, this is a forever unlock for $5 and you're bad, right?
That's on you. That's why I haven't done it, because I know it'll result in 1,000,000 1-star reviews. And the reality is, customers hold that they 1-star review system, it basically holds us hostage as app developers. Like, we can't do anything about that, and those, like, that's why I haven't done it. Like, I'm losing money every single time those people use my app, but it's not worth the hostage situation of of, you know, having all these people one star review me and kill my business. So I can't really do it. I just have to support them forever. So Casey, don't do that. Maybe, maybe I think John's, but at least, you know, but again, like, you don't have server costs yet, at least, to worry about. So that's a huge difference.
But you do have that API to chase. Like, I mean, you're like, oh, that'll be free forever. Does that mean it won't change forever? Right.
Yeah,
like,
no, they're exactly
they could
right.
change the API, or they can add things to the API, or they can break the API and it, like, oops, they put it, rolled out a new release and it broke your app. And now you're scrambling to fix that. Like, they didn't do that to screw you. It's just a thing that happens because you don't control them. They don't probably don't even know you exist, considering they won't answer your emails. Right. Which means that things they do can affect your app immediately with no notice. And that is the type of thing that you have to be willing to wrangle. So either the app works and you're on board to wrangle that, in which case you kind of need some minimum amount of money to keep doing that, whether it's from acquiring new customers or a subscription, or the app doesn't work and then you just sunset it and whatever.
Right, exactly. And so that's why I'm leaning towards subscription. And for what it's worth, I was always planning on having like a 1 week free trial, but it's still tough because I still need to have some amount of functionality that is there to give you a taste so that when I present the paywall, you're not like, no. And so in a Slack that we're all a part of, you know, I've been going back and forth with a few mutual friends where, you know, initially I was told, and I think justifiably, well, my paywall was too aggressive too soon, etc. And my thinking at the time was, well, you know, that's what the 1 week free trial is for, but I can see how that would appear to be exploitative and that it would appear that I'm just hoping and praying that people forget to cancel that free trial. And so, you know, I
wouldn't characterize it that way for the record, but go ahead.
I'm happy to be convinced that I'm wrong about this as well, but I moved the paywall back a little bit. But then, you know, some mutual friends were saying, well, you've moved it back so far that now I probably would never bother paying for the app at all. And that's also not good. So I'm having a bit of trouble figuring out where is the appropriate line and where do I say, tough noogies, you're going to have to sign up now.
I haven't been in that conversation too much. I've seen a little bit of it, but has the idea come up of, which is, used to be very common in shareware type things, of allowing the full functionality a limited number of times and saying, you know, if someone actually wants to buy the app, they'll use it more than that number of times. And so they get to experience the full breadth of the functionality. But then after they use it the fifth time, it's like, okay, well, you've used up your, you know, 4 free uses for the day or whatever, like that type of thing where you're not simply choosing functionality that is in front of or behind the paywall, but instead like following usage patterns and saying you can use the app this amount over this period of time for free, but if once you exceed that you have to pay, presuming that someone who gets enough utility of it will use it more than that number of times and hit the paywall, but they will hit it after having experienced the full functionality of your app. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and that actually was recommended earlier today, and I'm probably gonna go that route. I gotta see if how ugly it would be to implement.
You're just moving the problem to a different place, which is like, okay, but what is the right number of uses?
Exactly.
Over what period of time, right? Because what if someone watches like one movie a week, they're never going to hit it, right?
That's exactly right. And I think it would be a fairly small number. Like it would be enough for what I would consider to be a day or two of, you know, average use. And then again, I would stick with the free trial, I think. And if people really only use the app for a week and a day or something like that, and then that's it, okay, then maybe it's not for them. Like, I don't want to take your money unless you want to. I want you to give me your money. I don't want to take your money. You know what I mean?
What Marco was saying about what the App Store is actually like. What the App Store is actually like is you launch the app and you can't do a single damn thing until you absolutely positively agree to start a free trial right now.
Which is closer to the
that's
way
how the
this
App
was.
Store works. Like, there's so few apps, you can't even see what the UI looks like until you agree to pay for the in-app purchase, which has a 7-day free trial, which is nice, and you can cancel and pay nothing. But we're hoping you forget.
Yeah, and keep in mind also, Casey. I never make a stink about this because I always forget to with my people who give me test flights. But subscriptions on test flights are horrible.
Suck so bad. It makes me type my password. Ugh. Casey, make it stop.
Well, only last like a day, you know, and then they reset.
Yeah, and then you have to type your password again. And my password is long and complicated. And it's hard. It's just, I can't do it.
Yeah. Like anybody out there who's trying to send a test flight out to your friends to test an internet purchase.
Or Apple.
Don't
fix
bother.
This.
Like, just don't even bother because a test flight paywall sucks. It's impossible. It drives people crazy. You will lose everybody. Everyone will jump off your beta. It's hard enough to get people to keep beta testing your app. Like, a paywall instantly makes all your friends say, ah, forget it, and they quit, and they move on.
But of course, you want to test the IAP, so you actually do want people to test it, but they don't want to do that, because it's not like the real experience. The real experience, you can pay by, like, double-tapping the home button and using your face, but not in test flight, because reasons that Apple, you know, like, so it's just such a, this is just a beta tester thing, but it's not, you know, regular customers have to deal with this, but I've seen a couple different approaches. Is one, to make the restore purchases thing, just always say, yes, totally, you're fine, right? So you leave all the paywalls in there, but then you present people with, like, oh, restore purchases, and anybody who taps restore purchases says, oh, you totally paid. And then, so it avoids the whole authentication problem, but then you're not exercising your IAP flow, really. So,
right, exactly.
It's a pain.
Yeah, there's no good answer.
The
good answer is for Apple to make test flight IAP work like the real one does.
Yeah, exactly. I'll have to add some sort of hack. I hadn't considered that, but you're exactly right.
No, but honestly, the whole idea of, like, you know, having it be, you know, basically you have to subscribe to do almost anything, but it's a free trial. That's fine. I don't think that's that bad of a solution. And there's a reason why so many apps do that, because it works. It's effective, and people like free trials. Like, people like that. Like, that's not a bad idea, honestly. And so many apps, as John was saying, like, so many apps in the App Store, that's how they work, that are way crappier than yours. Like, that
but
have
you don't have
to
put it, like, literally
people.
The first thing that they see. Like, you can give them one or two searches for free.
Make
and
it
then,
the third
like,
thing they see.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's the thing. So, like, at first my thought was, oh, I forget exactly where I put the line, but basically you can search, but you can't drill into anything. Like, it'll show you search results, but then you don't get to see. So let's say I did a search for Ryan Reynolds. You could see that, oh, Ryan Reynolds is right there at the top. That's what I expect. But the moment you try to drill into Ryan Reynolds and see, like, the details about Ryan Reynolds, then it would throw up a paywall, which is, I think, probably a little too aggressive. So now, you know, what I was thinking is, oh, in the way it currently is, which is probably too lenient, is, oh, you can see the results, like, you can go from search to details, but anything that's linked from there, so, like, if you're looking at Ryan Reynolds, you couldn't drill into Deadpool or any of the other roles that he's had. At that point, when you try to drill into one of Ryan Reynolds's roles, then it would throw up the paywall. But then that means, worst case, you just go back up and search for Deadpool, and then you get to see Deadpool, you know. And so I think that's a little too permissive, and I'm not sure what the right answer is. But I mean, certainly in a Slack that we're all a part of, there was a visceral reaction that a free trial alone and putting up the paywall that quickly was absolutely the wrong answer, and I'm a fool for even thinking it was okay. So I don't know. I gotta figure out what the right answer is, and obviously I don't know.
And keep in mind also, like, once you've decided, all right, I'm gonna go subscription with a free trial of this duration with this annual price, then you can tweak the rest of it afterwards. Like, you can ship way, and all right, this is the business model, period. But then the detail of, like, well, how much do you get for free? When do I show the paywall? That can change over time. You can play with that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So I don't know. We'll see. But I'm excited for it. I think it was Marco, but one of you said this earlier. This, I think, has an even bigger space or potential market than anything I've done so far. Like, well, Vignette was different, but that was short-lived and that got sunset real quick. But if you look at Peak of View, you know, well, it's parents or people who hand their phones to other people a lot. And then Masquerade, well, it's people who actually care about privacy, which these days is almost no one. And I'm not saying that everyone in the world is looking for an IMDb replacement, but I think it's probably more people than are looking potentially for either of my other apps. And so here again, ignorance is bliss /lists.
No list puns. We're not doing that.
So sitting here now, I'm hopeful. And again, I'm proud of the work. Like, whether or not it's interesting to anyone, I'm proud of the work. And even if it ends up being a complete flop, I do think I'm getting better at my craft, which is what you were saying earlier, Marco, and I appreciate you having said that. I think I'm getting better at my craft, and I am proud of that. It is not a perfect app. It is not flawless. It probably has bugs somewhere, although it's been reasonably bug-free so far, which I'm pretty proud of. But it's the best I think I've got going so far, and it's a little bit better, if not a lot better, than Masquerade, which was, I think, a little to a lot better than Peak of View. And so I'm making progress, and I'm pretty happy about that. And even in a worst case scenario, you know, this doesn't take off, ATP suddenly goes away, analog goes away, and I need to find a big boy job again, then I have something to show for what I've been doing for the last several years, right? And well, in this case, the last couple of months, but in more broadly, the last several years. And I think that's a positive thing as well. And I'm learning how to use new stuff. And all of these things, I think, are nothing but good. So even if the app flops, which certainly I hope it doesn't, but even if it flopped, I still feel pretty good about what I've learned and how I've grown during the process. And that can be the end.
End. That's why I didn't say anything.
Fair enough.
Nice clean end.
the cycles of Marco, I think, has to be the winner. I don't think there's any question.
Yeah, that's pretty good. If I'm honest, I don't think we're going to do better than that. All right.
And John,
prod them in the threads? What the heck was that?
In the Slack threads, you prod Apple.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, that was easy.
This is a short list. Is this something wrong with the bot? Let me reload.
I also reloaded to check. I like, I don't want to log in, but yeah, I think cycles is fine.
Back button focusing. Yeah, for the bootleg dual gain / dual base ISO are the two competing industry terms for the thing that Sony's still cameras definitely don't have, according to Sony, but they kind of sort of do. They're video cameras. I have to refresh myself on details. I'll really talk about it in the next episode, but it was extremely enlightening. I found this YouTuber who was like, I'm a camera YouTuber. I'm a techie camera YouTuber. I'm a techie camera YouTuber who goes into long technical detail about specific features. I'm a techie camera YouTuber who goes into long specific technical details about one brand of camera. And it's the brand that you have. I'm like, yes.
This is for me.
It only applies to Sony cameras and only these Sony cameras. And let me go into way more detail than you ever wanted. I was just eating it up.
That's awesome. Well, yeah, I will have some new homes, some rehoming of my camera gear to do soon. Mm-hmm. Some of it might end up coming to you. I did actually, for the first time ever, I tried cleaning a sensor.
Oh, yeah, I've done that too. It's terrifying.
Piss out of me.
It's a terrible experience.
Not good. I bought a special kit for it.
Me
I'm
too,
like, I felt
yeah.
like a surgeon doing open heart surgery. Like, I don't want to do it. That's why I hate so much. Like, this is a feature that a bunch of cameras have. I'm like, why don't all cameras have this feature? The feature is, hey, when you take the lens off, why don't you close the damn shutter or some other thing to protect the sensor? Why don't they all do that?
Oh, that's but a only great some idea. Of them do. Why don't they do that?
Tons of them do it. I mean, that's not perfect because the dust still floats in there and then you put it opens back up. Like, it's not foolproof, but it's way better than not doing anything.
Does my new
and
Fuji I do just, that? Do we have an option for that?
No, our cameras don't do it. Like, it's not even that new. It's just like, I don't understand what it is about the cameras that do it and don't. But yes, it's some of them actually literally use the physical shutter. Some of them have their own like thing that goes over it. But it's like, please, everybody, implement this feature. I want them to implement this feature. I want them to also have little puffers that like exhaust all the dust that might have floated in there before you put the other thing. Instead, it's just like, hey, good luck. And just like you were apologizing for the dust on the sensors. It happens, and when it happens, it's maddening because you only find out after you get a bunch of pictures. Like, what is that smudge? Next picture. Oh my god. Next picture. Oh my god.
Yep.
It was like, remember when Tina went on vacation and she without me, but with the our
right.
fancy camera.
Yes,
and she
yes,
got a
yes.
it was there was a hair caught
that's
in
right.
like the shutter yeah. door, and every single picture had this hair in the upper left corner. Like it was like what is that? And I opened up the camera and I got a pair of tweezers and pulled it out. It was like an eyelash, like this tiny little hair, but when it's like right in front of the sensor, it screws up all your pictures. I could not believe it.
And it's fun. So for whatever it's worth, the in my history of mirrorless or my history of interchangeable lens cameras, the one that we had, I think, for the longest until the most recent Sony was the Canon 5D Mark II. We had those when they came out in 2008 for a number of years afterwards until we eventually went from that to Sony, like back, a number of years later.
Does that put the mirror down when you change lenses?
No, but the Canon, the 5D Mark II had this feature where it would like ultrasonically vibrate the sensor
to shake any dust off every
time you turn the camera off. Literally, you flip the camera off and it goes, and it like, it even says like sensor cleaning and then it turns off. And that, we have two of those. Those cameras never had dust on their sensors.
Do you think
was it just using
the in-body stabilization?
No, they didn't have that.
Oh, I just had the shaky thing because I was wondering, are the in-body stabilization shaky things sufficient? But I guess it probably doesn't move enough to.
It's probably not like
us.
An ultrasonic thing, and maybe having in-body stabilization precludes that from working.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe that's why these cameras don't have it anymore. But that feature, the 5D Mark IIs, we used those so much for so many years. We changed the lenses all the time. Those never got dust in the sensors. Every other interchangeable lens camera we've had has dust in the sensors.
So yeah, every time I change lenses, I feel like I need to go into a clean room and like I'm counting the milliseconds of how long it's exposed. Like, I always get the two pieces ready. I'm ready. I'm like, ready, unhook, down, up, down, you know, like exposed to the shark. It's like, you know, as fast as possible. And then I point it in the direction that's like away from like it's pointed down. So the dust would have to be floating up. And if there's wind, I'm like tucking it under. It's such a painful procedure to do. And I just wish like. Seal yourself up, man. Like when I turn the power off and I say, I'm about to change lenses, close the blast doors, everything, just protect that sensor at all costs, evacuate the chamber of all air. Let me put the thing, put it back on. And then there should be a re-exhaust, which is like recharge the airlock, expose. I mean, obviously nothing's going to totally protect it, but I do really wish more cameras would adopt the protection of the shutter. It seems to be more prevalent with time, but far from universal, and I don't quite understand it.
Although
maybe
there
is one more thing to break.
One thing that somebody wrote in, I'm sorry, I don't have the email handy, so I can't credit the person who wrote this in, but somebody wrote in over the last week or so to say, like, interchangeable lenses are better in the sense that at least if, because, like, you know, regular cameras,
yeah, yeah.
They're not, uh-huh. You know, you can still get dust on the sensor in a fixed lens camera.
Mm-hmm. And
you just have
screwed.
No access to it without disassembling the whole camera. And so at least with the interchangeable lens cameras, you can clean the dust off. Like, so mm-hmm. It is more likely that it will get in, but at least then you also can clean it.
Yeah.
Whereas
you would think the fixed lens cameras would
luck.
Be sealed up tighter, you know. But I guess, you know, it happens. I guess the dust can get in there. Yeah. I don't think I've ever had that happen with any of my non-interchangeable lens cameras. But boy, that would be a bummer, especially if it was an expensive one. You're like, what do I do now? I'm not going to take apart my own camera.
All right. We have some things we need to talk about without the live people. So goodbye, live people.
Are we in trouble?
No. Right. No. Nobody's in trouble.
All right. Thanks, live people. This was fun. And we will talk to you next week at the regular time, I believe, right? The Wednesday regular time?
As far as I know, that is the intention.
Yep,
we'll see what ends up happening.
Cool. All right. Bye, life people.